We're going to start the meeting in about 2 minutes.
It's just like it. You might as well have stayed on the plane and been all the way to Monterey.
Okay, we're going to call the commission meeting to order. My name is Jim Kellogg. I'm president of the commission from Discovery Bay. And on my immediate left is Michael Sutton, commissioner from Monterey.
Good morning.
On my immediate right is John Carlson, our executive director of the commission. And right of John is Adriana Shea, our deputy executive director. And on the far left over here is John Fisher, our other deputy executive director. We also have with us Craig Schumann, our marine advisor, I believe, is with us today out in the audience. We have Sherry Fonbuena, analyst with our commission. Anita Biederman, also analyst with our commission. And Carol Horn, executive assistant. We also have with us Rick Thalhammer, our deputy attorney general from the AG's office. And from the department, we're very fortunate to have the director of the Department of Fish and Game, John McCammon, with us today. We have Deputy Director Sankey Master, Deputy Director of Enforcement Nancy Foley. We also have in the audience Susan LeGrand, our Deputy Director of Legislation, Thomas Gibson, the General Counsel for the Department, and Eric Loft, Chief of the Wildlife Branch, is with us in the audience today. We also have Wardens Lori Oldfather with us today. We have Warden James Bogus, Warden Eric Mangs, and Assistant Chief John Baker, and Assistant Chief Rob Allen with us today. And I want to thank them for being here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our Executive Director, John Carlson, to make a few announcements and then get us started on our agenda.
Thank you. Thank you, President Kellogg. Good morning. I'd like to let you know that today's meeting is live stream videotaped and is going across the internet live right now, and an archive of that meeting will be available upon our website. We have about 7 years worth of meetings archived as a free service, so you can go to our website to get the link if you're interested. This is a public meeting under Bagley-Keene rules. If you want to speak on an item, turn in a green speaker card to staff under an agenda item, and keep your comments to that agenda item when you're on the microphone. Please introduce yourself when you first get to the microphone. We have a 10-minute speaking aggregate for the day, so if you're going to speak on several items, please choose your time wisely. I'd like to announce today that, unfortunately, we do not have a quorum of our body. We have two commissioners. We do not make the quorum of three. So today we will be taking public comment on all items. The items that are here for going to notice, staff will post the notices after the meeting. But any items that need votes, we are going to schedule a teleconference call as soon as possible, and those votes then will be taken. We also will not have an exec session today since we do not have a quorum. Items can be moved around on the agenda today, and some of that will happen. We're going to start with item two, presentation of resolution honoring former Commissioner Cindy Gustafson, and then we'll go to public forum right after that. So I'd like to get started on that. Okay. We have a, is Cindy still in the house? There she is. Why don't you come on up, Cindy? We'll embarrass you as much as we can. I do not have a camera.
Here?
That is great. That is great. As many folks probably know, unfortunately, Cindy had to resign last summer, and we miss her very, very, very much. And we wanted to honor her years of service with the commission, and we have a resolution we're going to present to her. And a small token of our gratitude. I want to read this. California Fish and Game Commission resolution honoring Cindy Gustafson. Whereas you, Cindy Gustafson, were appointed to the California Fish and Game Commission by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger on June 20th, 2005. And whereas you served as vice president of the commission from 2007 to 2008, and you served as president in 2009, and where you strongly advocated public participation in the commission processes and insisted on accountability of the department and the commission in public resource matters, and whereas you were pivotal in elevating the stature and professionalism of the commission while stressing the need for increased warden staffing to protect fish and wildlife by enforcing natural resource laws, and now, therefore, be it resolved that this commission pauses in its order of business to acknowledge the sacrifices and contributions you made in helping this body meet its statutory responsibilities as stewards of the resources and servant of the public good. And further, be it resolved that this commission will miss your enthusiasm and unwavering commitment to the wise management of California's valuable and diverse natural resources. And finally, be it resolved that the Fish and Game Commission wishes you the best in your future endeavors. May the friendships that you developed while on the commission remain forever. And may you be afforded the enjoyment of many days on the ski slopes, golf courses, and tropical beaches in the future.
Yep.
Is anybody going to take a picture or no? I just want to say, as president of the commission, that when Cindy resigned from the commission, she was the president, and the commission has done nothing but gone downhill since she left and left me in the president's seat, because no matter how long I'm here, I could never fill the shoes that Cindy wore as president of this commission. We haven't had anybody do a better job in all the years I've been here, and really miss her and appreciate the work she did. And the commission has a belt buckle that we also want to present to Cindy as a token of our appreciation for the job that she did. So, Commissioner Sutton, would you join me?
What do you think? Did we barely recognize?
Jim, Mr. President, can I address the commission briefly ahead of public forum?
You absolutely can. By the way, Cindy came all the way down here for this from Tahoe City this morning or last night, so thank you for doing that.
You don't know
that.
The half of it. I just wanted to say a few things. It was such a privilege to serve with you, both of you and the others that aren't here today. And no offense to the two of you, but I think really the privilege was working with the Department of Fish and Game and the staff of the Fish and Game Commission, getting to know the wardens and the management staff and directorate of the department, the incredible commitment of the people that are in this room to preserving our resources and taking care of the natural resources we hope to leave to our children. It was just a great, great privilege and honor, and I'm sure I have a lot of fun memories of our constituents and a lot of good humor with the commissioners and our staff. Thank you for everything you do, for AGV, for making sure that everybody in the world knows what we're doing. It's so important. And thanks again. I love the buckle, Adriana. Good job. Thanks.
Mr. President, before Cindy escapes, I just want to add the congratulations and thanks of the department.
Hey, Cindy, you can't get away just yet. The department has a few comments.
I just wanted to add the congratulations and thank you for your service from the department on behalf of the department. So thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, and I might add that the for anybody who's counting budgets these days, the belt buckle was with private funds, not state funds. We're sorry to see Cindy go, but it was great to have her here this morning. We'll go to item number one, public forum now. Please note that any member of the public may address and or ask questions of the Commission relating to the implementation of its policies or any other matter within the jurisdiction of the Commission. The issue to be discussed should not be related to any item on the current agenda. If you want to speak on an item on the current agenda, please turn in a card for that item. As a general rule, action cannot be taken on issues not listed on the agenda. At the discretion of the Commission, staff may be requested to follow up on such items. Submittal of written comments is encouraged to ensure that all comments be included in the record before the Commission. Today, please be prepared to summarize your comments within the time allocated by the President, which is 2 minutes per person, and if there's some cards ceded to you, you'll get extra time for that. So we're going to start off. I'll call three names at a time. Be prepared to come up as soon as your name is called, and like I say your name for the record. We've got, and if I mess up any of the pronunciations, please forgive me. Ochoa Ray, followed by Bill Bernard, followed by Caitlin Gaffney. Is Ray Ochoa here? Come on, as soon as I call your name, up to the microphone, please.
Ray Ochoa, I represent Mr. Harvey Gonzalez. He's on the agenda for executive closed session. I've been told that due to a lack of a quorum that I will be given an opportunity to address the commission at a future date.
That's true.
Okay. So does the commission have a date, a month or?
Not set yet, but there will be a minimum of a 10-day notice out on our website and when a date is set for a teleconference call.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bill Bernard, followed by Caitlin Gaffney, followed by Scott Williams.
Good morning, Commission, Department staff, My name is Bill Bernard. I was a member of the Abalone Advisory Group. Before you in your late information docket, you have two documents for your consideration as we move forward with your recreational abalone fishery. I'd like you to please look them over and consider that process for the June Fish and Game Commission meeting. You're welcome.
Caitlin Gaffney, Scott Williams, Johnny Liu.
Good morning, Caitlin Gaffney with Ocean Conservancy. At the Commission's April meeting, you had a request from the Kashaya Band of Pomo Indians of the Stewart's Point Rancheria to place an issue on your agenda. I believe that request is going to be repeated today. So on behalf of Ocean Conservancy, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Humboldt Bay Keeper, and the Russian River Keeper, I'm here today to support agendizing that item. Thank you.
Scott Williams, Johnny Liu, Tom Raftikin. If you have papers to hand in, please get those to the staff before your time starts. Thank you.
Mr. President Kellogg, members of the commission, I'm Scott Williams. I'm here on behalf of the Kashaya Pomo Indian Tribe at Stewart's Point. The Marine Life Protection Act regulation for that area of the coast went into effect this past week. It will have a significant adverse impact on the tribe. We are asking, again, that the commission please give us an opportunity to work with you and your staff to resolve this. I'm confident that we have a resolution that will work, that is consistent with the act, that will protect resources, which are tremendously important to the Indian people of that tribe. When I was last here a month ago, the commission asked several questions which we have undertaken to answer in the materials which are being presented to you right now. Commissioner Rogers asked questions about the history of the tribe. He asked for details about the nature of the resources that are used by the tribe. And then thirdly, he asked for information about ceremonies, spiritual and religious ceremonies that are conducted by the tribe. We have provided you that there are two sources for the history here, Indian people themselves and then scholars. We have provided to you significant references to the scholarship on Pomo Indians, which goes back to between 10 and 13,000 years. We have provided you with details as to the nature of the fish that they catch, the shellfish that they take, the seafood that they use, and when and where they do that. With respect to the religious ceremonies, with apologies, we have not been able to provide you with that information. The tribe does not release that information to the public. They do not release it to their lawyer. We will be pleased to work with you to figure out how to address those problems in a way which is consistent with the law. Thank you very much, President.
Hold on a minute. He had a question for you.
Thank you, Scott. Can you tell us how long you've represented the tribe in this matter? How long have you worked for the tribe?
It's either 4 or 5 months.
Okay. I just have two comments, Mr. President, on this issue. Obviously, the legislature, when they enacted the Marine Life Protection Act, did not create a native exemption, as we have in a number of other federal and state statutes. What you're asking us to do here, Scott, is create a native exemption by regulation or by commission policy. Now, I have no problem with that in theory, and I look forward to reading your petition, your suggestions, and so forth. But it has to be said at the same time that the Marine Life Protection Act on the North Central Coast went through an elaborate process of more than a year, public hearings and Blue Ribbon Task Force meetings, regional stakeholder group meetings, and so forth. You'd have to have been asleep on the North Central Coast not to know that this was going on. It has to be asked, Scott, that if this matter is so important to your clients, where were they in that year, more than year-long process at which all of this was debated at great length among the many stakeholders that are involved in the MLPA process? It just makes us wonder just how serious your clients actually take this if they weren't present at any of the meetings running up to our decision. As I say, I have no problem with what you're suggesting, but it is not exactly timely.
It's a very serious question. It's a legitimate question, and I can respond in 30 seconds, and I would love an opportunity to have a discussion about this. The tribe submitted a request for what they refer to as a government-to-government consultation with the MLPA staff. There was no response to that request. Secondly, it never occurred to them in their wildest nightmares that the result of an effort to preserve the resources of the coast would somehow bring about the consequence that their ceremonial activities would be prohibited. It just didn't occur to them. And then the last point is that this is an extraordinarily poor community. They do not have the staff to send to meetings, to monitor these things. It's just very difficult. There is more. I do not make excuses for this. I'm explaining how it came to this.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Johnny Liu, Johnny K. Liu, Tom Raptikin, Chris Iverson.
Okay, do I have 3 minutes?
You have 2 minutes. Step away from the microphone a little bit, please.
Yeah, my name is Johnny Liu. I'm a retired project engineer. I used to work for Delta Switchboard Company. By banning the sale of the turtle and fox and etc., that will put a lot of people out of work. Especially in the San Francisco Chinatown area. Remember what the President of the United States said? Obama said his main goal is to create jobs. By laying off people in San Francisco Chinatown or elsewhere, the Asian would be our job, and that one will not meet his quota, create a job. The Asians had eaten this turtle and fox for many, many hundred years. And they are healthy, and there's nothing wrong with them, okay? So thank you so much. All right.
Tom Raftikin, followed by Chris Iverson, followed by Pius Lee.
Mr. President, members of the Commission, good morning. Tom Raftikin, President of the Sport Fishing Conservancy, and actually coming here, I'm also a member of the Marine Fish Advisory Committee to the Secretary of Commerce, and one of the things that we do is help with recommendations, and we help put together a recreational fishing summit with NOAA. This is this past April, the 16th and 17th, and it was held in Alexandria, Virginia, and managed to have about 170 people there. Really a very good a forum. Some of the things that came up were building trust that had been broken, I guess, during the last administration, marine spatial planning, and catch shares, which were the main focus of the event. This was pre-oil spill, so there was really nothing there about that, which seems to have changed a lot of the focus of what's going on with recreational fishing on a national stage. One of the main things that came out of it, though, is that NOAA has appointed Russell Dunn as basically a liaison between recreational fishing and NOAA. And it's a pretty good model for how do we get information back and forth and how do you continue to build trust. One of the suggestions I had would be to bring Russell, when he's out here, to one of the marine subpanel meetings, a good chance to start building some of the relationships between NOAA and you folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Tom. I've worked with Russ Dunn for years, and I know him well. I like that suggestion. I saw that he'd been appointed to that post, and we would certainly welcome that at the Marine Resources Committee. So if you can arrange it in your capacity as a MAFAC member, that would be great.
Let me work on that, and we'll see if we can get them down to one of the sub-panel meetings. I think it's
great.
A good way to keep the dialogue open, and it helps putting stuff up on the agenda so you folks can see it before it actually hits. So, thanks.
Chris Iverson, Pius Lee, Ben Richard. Oh.
Good morning. My name's Christian John Iverson. I come before you as a 35-year veteran California fisherman and a type 2 diabetic. You had a closed-door meeting on April 8th on reinstating my sea urchin permit, and it was denied. And I do not believe that this was legal. I think that I was discriminated against under the American Disabilities Act when the department declared my illness as being an illness instead of diabetes. I would like the commission to reconsider their denial of my permit and give me a chance to bring in more information. Give me my history that I've been asking for since the beginning of this 2 years ago on May 8th when we started this in 08. Like I said, I just don't think that I've been properly heard in this matter for the last 2 years, and I'd like a chance to bring it before you. I think that's about all I got to say.
Pius Lee has cards seated to him, so he gets 6 minutes.
Okay. Good morning, Commissioner. I'm the chair of the Chinatown Economic Development Committee, and I represent some of the small fish market in San Francisco Chinatown, and a petition with almost 1,000 signatures I just submit to you to ask you to reconsider the decision you made on March 3rd to stop issuing permit for the importation of live native frog and turtle for food. Because in your March 3rd meeting, there was no mention in your agenda, item 12, saying that you are going to stop issuing permit. And also, you ignore your commission policy of April 3rd, 1998, in Long Beach public hearing. Let me give you some background on this issue. Almost 13 years ago, more than 15 pro-animal groups came before your commission and asked the ban for the importation of turtle and frog. They used the same argument as they used in your March 3rd meeting by saying that the method used to kill the animal were inhumane, violate animal cruelty law, and releasing the turtle and frog to public water and pose a threat to the state native turtle and frog. Okay, in April 3rd, 1998 public hearing, the commission gave us a chance to respond, but in the public hearing on March 31st, 2010, we did not have the opportunity to respond. For your information, the commission gave the fish market in April 1st, 1998, an order to post a public sign like this one in all the fish market that if you obey the law and we are not going to propose the ban on importation for importation. Okay? So it is our understanding that if you obey the rule and you are not going to propose the ban. But we comply the commission's order on April 3rd, 1998, and we work together with your patrol lieutenant, Mao Yang, I understand he's retired, to post all this site in all the fish market throughout the state of California, okay? So after that time, pro-animal group were still not certified and asked former Assemblyman Sheila Quill to sponsor the bill AB 2479, which cover all the pro-animal group concern, such as no animal will be dismembered, flayed and cut open, or have its skin removed while animal is still alive. Any operator who fails to comply with the rule with the first violation will be given written warning, and second violation will be fined from 250 to 1,000. We sponsor AB 238 by former Assembly Mike Honda, which requires both operator to post sign on all the window. Both bills became law on January 1, 2001. All the fish market operator follow and rely on the rule to operate and handle the sale of turtle and frog. On our meeting in Chinatown, April 22nd, all the fish market operators indicate to us they received no notice of violation. Okay, so in other words, we compare with all the law and rule. Okay, so I hope that you consider to revoke this ban. If you don't, manager will be lost and sales tax will be reduced. Instead of the ban, Commissioner, we strongly recommend and ask you to consider to enforce the existing law. The existing law, AB 2479 and AB 238, we cover all the pro-animals concerned, okay? And also, we recommend you should develop educational program regarding this issue to the general public, including the pet store too, which they can sell live turtle. Okay, okay. Thank you very much for your time, Commissioner, and thank you,
Commissioner Sutton.
Mr. President, just a couple clarifications I think would be useful here. And Sankey, correct me if I'm wrong, but on the first one, first of all, the Commission's action on the import of non-native live frogs and turtles did not ban the sale of these animals in the live food markets, but simply directed the Department to cease issuing import permits. So this is an import ban, not a sale ban. Secondly, the primary concern, I think I can speak for the Commission, that our primary concern was the impact of these imports on native fish and wildlife populations in California. Our primary mission, our primary job here is to protect and conserve the native fish and wildlife of California against whatever threats. And one of those threats is import of non-native or exotic species, whatever they may be, for whatever purpose. So that's our primary motivation here. Thanks.
Okay, but I got the pass for you the same statement that yeah. Commissioner Sutton had with the Indian tribe earlier, and that is that we have been discussing this for some time now. And it wasn't until after this decision was made that we heard from you and Assemblyman Lee and the community. And my question is, where was everybody during the process? And then that being said, I've heard from not only you, but a lot of personal friends from San Francisco as well. Including my good friend Jerry Halsey, and that's meaningful to me as a commissioner and people that I respect and know have the best interest at heart when they make contact with me. Lost my train of thought there, but where I was headed with this is. We want to hear the testimony. We can't do any decisions today. We can't vote on anything. But we want to hear the testimony from the people. But want you to know that they need to be more aware of what's going on in their business, because this has been an ongoing process, and the people that brought it to us a few years ago.
Okay.
And so. Why, Commissioner Sutton, I want to hear the testimony is that even though we banned the import, they can't get these things without import licenses. Yes. So we have to listen to what their concerns are, because I don't want to, I mean, I agree with what we did, but maybe there's more people who are abiding by the law than there are who aren't, and we need to weigh that in the process. So I'm ready to listen to the rest of the testimony.
May I answer to Commissioner one of the questions? You know, by stopping issuing the permit means to say that at the end, at the permit expire end of the year, there will be no more import permit to buy turtle and frog. In other words, each of them will lose about 20% business here. And but I think your concern that about the releasing the turtle and frog to the wild that will hurt the local native. But Commissioner, we don't understand. We have blue and on the boat. Anybody who want to release it or offend, they are subject 250 to 1,005. And all the people who want to buy a turtle and frog in the fish market, before you go out, you have to kill the turtle in a humane way before you can take it out. You can sell, you cannot buy live turtle or frog on the fish market. Okay, but the key point, without the permit for importation, there will be no more turtle and frog in California. Even though you can sell, but where do you get it? We cannot catch the local native and turtle to sell. We are prohibited, you know. So I would really want you to understand the whole picture, you know. By stop issuing the permit means lost many jobs and also lose the opportunity for the China American to eat fresh seafood.
Thank you for your testimony. Let me ask you one last question. In many cases where the import of exotic wildlife has been banned, the trade is replaced by captive bred animals. The bird trade is a good example of that. To your knowledge, is there any captive breeding of these frogs and turtles for the live food markets in California or the United States? Did anybody breed them in captivity for sale, or are they all imported from overseas?
Well, I know it's all imported mostly from Taiwan, but not in California. But through some of the fish market operator importer, they said from other states too. They do have some import from other states. Eh?
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Richard O. Henry Chung, David Chu.
My name is Richard O. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm going to read a letter from Assemblyman from Fiona Ma and Ted Liu, Paul Fong, Lilin Yi, Juan Perini, Mike Ng. California Legislature, May the 4th, 2010, member of the California Fish and Game Commission. Dear Commissioners, as member of the California Legislature, we are writing this to ask you to reconsider the March 3rd, 2010 motion to establish a policy to ban the importation of turtles and frogs for food consumption. Invasive non-native species have devastating impact on California ecology, ecosystem, and year after year, newly introduced species such as the mitten crabs and Quaker mussel threaten the state's waterways. We applaud the work that you have done to protect California from all invasive species. However, we believe that the recent motion passed on live food importation lack input from stakeholders and may not impact the goal of protecting California's fragile ecosystem. We understand that one basis for the Commission's decision is the threat of non-native species being released into the wild. A disturbing part of your recent decision is that appears to disproportionately target Asian American owned businesses. The decision does not impact the sale of turtles and frogs at the pet retail store. Were a consumer still able to bring home a live turtle or frog that could be subsequently released into the wild?
Okay, you need to wrap up because your time's up.
Yes, I'm reading a letter from the senators, from the legislatures. There are a number of drastic effects that this decision will have on seafood markets across the state. Turtles and frog are traditional culture. Okay, in conclusion,
we've got a copy of the letter here for
you. Have a copy. Yeah. Sir, may I speak on my behalf? I did put in a card to speak.
You just used up your time, though. Well, we got to limit everybody to 2 minutes, or we'll never get done. Okay. Thank you.
Henry Chung, David Chu, Ari Chu. Let me let everyone know that the letter from Assemblywoman Fiona Ma, we received that yesterday. We all have that letter. So sorry for any confusion on that. Go ahead.
Mr. President, Fish and Game Commission, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is David Chu from Oakland, California. I'm here today as objection Fish and Game Commission ban on the importation permit for non-native turtles and frogs into California, also not for human consumption, saying this non-native animal will affect the native turtles and frogs is not fair to cultures that eat frogs and turtles. I do some research under this scientific name of red-eared turtles and American bullfrogs. The American bullfrogs and red-eared turtle was discovered and introduced to California in earlier year 1900s. They do exist in our wildlife environment over the past 110 years. These are native animals, and that's why we call American bullfrogs. Framing import of non-native turtles and frogs released into the wild is not fair to cultures that eat frogs and turtles. According to Assembly Bills AB 238 and AB 2479 were introduced in 1999 and 2000 to make sure no live turtle for frogs or frogs will be released to the public. There's no evidence found in framing from the import non-native turtles and frogs released from the store and supermarket. This point, I do also do some research too. Say found thought out throughout California, released to the wild from the pets trade are largely responsible. That's the research. Asian seafood market are open to suggestions and ideas on how to prevent live turtles and frogs from being released to the native nature. Our bottom line is to save our eating culture, because this culture is the root. Just like our Thanksgiving eating turkey, banning import of non-native turtles and frogs for human consumption will affect thousands of restaurant businesses financially, hundreds of seafood market wholesaler and freight service agents, millions of consumers with this product eating cultures. the harmony between cultures and create cultural tension. The already high unemployment rate of California.
Okay, you need to wrap up because your time's up.
Sorry. Mr. President, I wish our commission reconsider not to ban on the importation permit of non-native turtles and frogs. Allow us a chance to save our culture. Thank you very much.
David Chu, Eric Chu, Paul Lee.
Good morning, Commissioner. My name is Henry Chung. I'm from San Francisco. As a civic distributor, it has been always been very challenging to stay in business. Challenges include being in compliance to the FDA regulations, the federal government, Fish and Wildlife, State of California, Department of Fish and Game, Department of Health Service, Food and Drug Branch. We have to maintain a HACCP program and also inspect by the City of San Francisco, Department of Public Health. Since passage of AB 2479 and AB 238, we have constantly reminding all retailers and restaurants which we do business with to kill all frogs and turtles before selling off their premises. The chances of soft-shell turtles and frogs are released to the wild are almost minimal. And I have never heard of release of frogs or soft-shell turtle to the wild. Maybe the hard shell. But they can get those from the pet shops very easy. If this bill is enforced, it will have a great economic impact. Many jobs will be lost directly or indirectly because the fish market restaurant, they hire a lot of people to do the job. And the delivery driver and the airline, because we ship it to the other state. And if we cannot import the non-native light soft shell turtle, Thank you very much.
Eric Chu, Paul Lee, and then Ming Fat Seafood Company.
Good morning. My name is Eric Chu from Oakland, California. My idea is pretty much the same of the other one. And the one thing I just want to point out is we just feel unfair for our food industry because just only bank the importation license for food. And last Sunday, I do some research. I went to all the pet store, and I have a receipt, and I bought frog and turtle. If I don't sacrifice, I can release the wild, whatever I want. And at that point, is we just feel unfair. And also, in all the past, all those years, we don't see any evidence or report to saying people are eating the frog and turtle have sick and illness. Thank you.
Paul Lee, Ming Fat Seafood Company, David Lee.
Hi, my name is Paul Lee. I have a fish market in San Francisco. I am doing business for over 30 years. I've been selling frog and soft-shell turtles. Me and my hundreds or thousands of customers, they've been eating the frog and the soft-shell turtle as our health food intake. And we follow the Fish and Game, the rule how to handle the animals. And also, health department come in, check our store from time and time. They are very satisfied how we handle the frog and how we take care of the turtles. We don't want let any frog or soft shell turtle go into the wild. We have to kill them before they leave our store. If the fish game ban on the importation of a fort, and we don't have a fort to sell, and we lost a lot of business. And then we have to lay off some of the people, and they will go on unemployment. We don't want to see this happen, so I come here, please, and let's keep selling the fort and soft sell turtle. Thank you.
Ming Fat Seafood Company, David Lee from New United Supermarket, Jamie's Market.
Good morning, everybody. JB Supermarket.
He's the proprietor for a seafood supermarket. Can we put the time in 4 minutes since he needs interpretation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
18 years of seafood business in San Francisco. At this time, the business is terrible. Different species of seafood is getting less and less.
再不如无辜地禁止我们买田鸡水要乌龟?
Why is this time cut off the import of turtles and forks?
我们减少了，即系我哋少咗收入咧，就必然炒咗啲工人。
When our income is less, we have to lay off people.
同時呢，各個商家呢，亦少咗交國家嘅税啦，納税啦。The
merchants will pay less taxes.
政府呢，除咗負擔我哋越來越多嘅失業人員，即係，the government
have to pay the worker for unemployment benefits.
亦少咗税收入。
Also less income from taxes.
我強烈呼籲呢，在座各位支持我哋民間水要乌龟。
We urge your commission to continue our business of selling forks and turtles from imported resources.
支持我哋中國人嘅飲食文化。
Respect our culturally consumption of turtles and forks for good health.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
David Lee, Jamie's Market, Ken S.
Morning.
早晨, good morning.
我哋鋪頭就已經張貼咗嗰個post 同埋嗰啲田雞唔准劏咗先至得走。
Our fish shop post the sign that we will not let you take out live forks or turtles.
亦都從來冇收過違章嘅嗰個信。
We have never received a citation from violation of this message.
今年唔知係咪因為天氣嘅問題，啲魚一個 fish department 嗰啲魚嘅數量少咗，如果再冇田雞同埋水魚賣。
For this season, for many months, the supply of fish is less.
如果唔准买田鸡咧，就可能要减少人手，因为生意淡咗。
If we ban the selling of turtles and forks, the business will be terrible.
同埋唔准买田鸡同埋水鱼咧，影响亚洲人嘅饮食习惯。
It will also affect our consumption for good health of turtles and forks that all the Asians believe in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jamie's Market, Ken S., New Ocean Seafood Company. Does anyone hear from Jamie Market? Okay, how about Ken S. Market? New Ocean Seafood?
Well, they are the same issue. Hopefully, they oppose
the same, right.
Same
so there, we'll put, we'll note the that they're.
Business,
yep.
More unemployment, you know, something. Same issue.
Okay, thank you. That moves us to Paul Weakland, and then Bob Bentz.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Here again, we request that we quit this fooling around the injustices that you were pulling on the people of the state of California, in particular, the inefficient, ineffective, and lack of any real management of the abalone resource. We request that you immediately open for the harvest of abalones the counties of San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Cruz, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo counties. We have heard time and time again that poaching is going uncontrolled in these areas. If there's no abalones there, how come the poachers are coming away with hundreds and thousands of abalones that the legal citizens are not allowed to be able to access? And another injustice is these people here. My God, last month at your last meeting, a detrimental species from a foreign country that you're going to allow in this state for the first time. Yet, turtles and frogs have been here for many, many years, and so have these people paying taxes. But now, with your friends, your buddies in aquaculture, you're turning the tide. You're tilting the playing field. You're changing the topography. Oh, oh, oh! Want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about some stock in a Mariculture Ponzi Consortium? They need more investors. You know it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. Give these people a break. They've been here for many years paying taxes, unlike your aquaculture speculators from the East Coast and Australia. That is all.
Bob Bentz, Virginia Hanley.
I'm going to feel a little like a voice in the wilderness here. Hi, my name's Bob Bentz. I'm fourth-generation Stocktonian. I used to be a hunter, but the voters gave the bears and the mountain lions more right to the game than me, so I don't hunt anymore. But I was foolish enough to buy a lifetime fishing license. And with that came a Bay Delta Enhancement stamp. And, well, you guys well know, we don't have any wardens anymore. So it's, you know, it's open season out there. You can take anything you want. We don't plant trout anymore either. Anyway, you guys took my endowment from my lifetime fishing license, and you didn't spend it as intended, as promised. What do you guys plan to do for me or other lifetime fishing license holders? Is a refund appropriate? Maybe you could substitute an abalone check card. I would hope you would give some consideration to that. Aside from that, since we don't have wardens anymore, around here we have volunteers in police service, and we have STARS with the Sheriff's Department. They're retired people like me who go out in the community and keep their eyes and ears open and get sponsored by the community and help law enforcement do their job. I wonder if you guys would consider such a program for fish and game, because we don't have the wardens to protect the resource. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks much.
Virginia Hello. Hanley.
Thank you. Virginia Hanley with the PAWPAC. I just wanted to add a P.S. on comments that have been made about the turtle frog importation. And I've been asked to, Eric Mills asked me to tell you, too. He has worked hard to find the shelters that will take these animals. We're concerned that to send them back to their state of origin, they're probably not even going to survive the trip, because a lot of them are sick already. It would be better for them to, if they can, to go to a local shelter and probably be euthanized unless there's a rescue group, and they're pretty much filled up. So for the benefit of those animals, and for their welfare, and their humane treatment. We'd prefer if they stayed here and be euthanized if necessary. Thank you.
Okay, that concludes public testimony. Because we don't have a quorum today, we can't take any official action. But in view of the testimony that we have had today and the request from our friends in the Assembly and Senate, I'm going to ask staff. We will have a follow-up commission meeting by teleconference, the date of which we don't have yet. There will be sufficient notice for that. And I'm going to ask Commissioner Sutton and I have agreed to ask staff to agendize this item to consider the commission's policy on non-native, to reconsider the commission's policy on non-native frogs and turtles at that meeting. And thank you all for showing up.
This morning I forgot to announce that the counter in the back is open if you want to buy soda or water, beverages. I recommend against alcohol right now, but I wasn't looking at anybody in particular.
Sarah next for number 3.
Great. Right. Okay. Where's Jim?
He went to the restroom.
Right. Okay, we're going to move on to item number 3, which is update on the 2010 federal duck stamp contest. Originally, we had Marie Strasburger, from the Chief of Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat for the Pacific Southwest Fish and Wildlife Service, scheduled to give the talk. She was unavailable today. So we have Sarah Swente, who is the coordinator of the 2010 Federal Duck Stamp Contest, to give us this presentation today. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, John. As John mentioned, my name is Sarah Swente. I am the regional coordinator for the 2010 Federal Duck Stamp Contest, and on behalf of the Pacific Southwest region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is hosting the contest, I'd like to invite everyone here today, the commission members, staff, members of the audience, to join us in Berkeley for the 2010 Federal Duck Stamp Contest. You can learn more information at this website, which will be available at the end of the slideshow as well. Never before has this contest come to California. In fact, it's never been further west than Minnesota before. This contest has been going on since 1934, but it only recently started traveling. To have this prestigious contest in the heart of urban Berkeley will provide us with a unique opportunity to introduce non-traditional audiences to the importance of wetlands and wildlife conservation. Next slide. Before I say more about the contest, I'd like to share just a little bit of history about the duck stamp. Many of you here know that in order to hunt migratory waterfowl, you need to purchase a duck stamp. But what a lot of people don't realize is that duck stamp will also get you a non-hunter onto all of the wildlife refuges within the federal system. So that $15 stamp is your access pass. And really, it's also your best investment in habitat conservation that you could ever make. 98 cents of every dollar goes directly into purchasing habitat. If we could convince, there are over 6 million wildlife watchers in California, only 281,000 hunters, of which only 150 hunt waterfowl in California, and there's almost 1.7 million fishermen. If we could convince 5%, only 5% of waterfowl wildlife watchers and anglers in the state, we could add an extra $6 million every year to the national refuge system. So little stamp, big results. Next slide. So about the contest. This contest is the only federally sponsored art contest in the United States. It's actually really incredible that there's one art contest the government sponsors, and it is for the art that goes on the hunting stamp. Every year, a noted panel of noted art artists, waterfowl enthusiasts, and stamp collectors are appointed by the Secretary of Interior to judge the art. The judging takes place over 2 days and is open to the public. Doors open at 10, and it will be held at the David Brower Center. Seating is limited, so get there early. Winners, the artists compete for this prize every year, not because they receive any money, they don't, but they receive a lot of recognition. It's actually a very, very well-known contest within the wildlife artist community, and a lot of people haven't heard of it because it's a small community, but it's very avid believers in the benefits. So new this year, it is California. We have to do a little bit with technology. We're going to stream the contest live for the first time ever. At least we plan to. God forbid something doesn't work out. But we also have a Facebook page, and we'll have a live Twitter feed from the floor of the judging. So, you know, people can connect in new ways, and that's our goal, is to reach new people. So, next slide. We don't want this contest to only be here for 2 days. This is a big deal. And so we're going to extend the celebration to the whole week prior to the contest. And we're working with our partners, like actually the Department of Fish and Game, California Waterfowl, Ducks Unlimited, Audubon, the Central Valley Joint Venture, and the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture are very active partners right now. And we're looking for others within the park system, anybody who has access or knowledge of wetlands, of waterfowl, of migratory birds, of birds in general, who wants to get out. You can work together to celebrate local efforts. So not everybody is going to make it to Berkeley, but this is a regional contest. It's a regional sponsored event. So we want to help other people throughout the region understand the importance of the duck stamp. Next slide. Things that are in the works right now include wetlands tours, bird walks. Again, we're going to stream it live, so you can have an off-site webcast party and invite your friends to watch the duck stamp contest, especially the last day on Saturday when the winner's chosen. Reno Cabela's is actually going to host one of those. We know that for sure already. So working on that. And then, of course, I have more information. If there's anybody here who's interested, we have put together a letter with an event coordination form. All of these events will be listed in the program. We're going to list it on the website and on Facebook as well, so people can really connect with your organization. Next slide. And in closing, I'd like to once again invite everyone here today, the commission members, staff, to join us for the Federal Duck Stamp Contest in Berkeley, and join your friends, neighbors, and your favorite nonprofit organizations at outdoor events throughout the region during Duck Stamp Week this coming October.
Commissioner Sutton.
Mr. President, I think the commission should volunteer to be the judges of this competition, considering this is the first time it's been in California.
Well, we have, the judges are already picked out.
I was afraid of that.
It's quite a process, actually, but we would love to have you there, and have a member of the commission as an honored guest would be a great.
Well, if you think it's going to be 76 years again before you come back to California, I think we will attempt to be there.
Exactly. It's a pretty once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see it here, so please do.
Well, we are very honored to have you come to California for this, and want to thank you for that on behalf of all the commission.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. We have no public speaker cards on item 3. Moving on to item 4, consideration and possible adoption ratification of commission findings on the petition to list the California tiger salamander as an endangered species. And 4B, consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 670.5, Title 14, related to the addition of California tiger salamander to the list of animals of California declared to be threatened. We do not have a quorum today, but the department does have some comments on this. Dr. Eric Loft, UC Davis. I mean, fishing game.
Good morning, commissioners. Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch. And really all we're here today to do from the department's perspective is advise you that we've submitted to you some draft findings for your consideration on the California tiger salamander. And we have our legal representation and us to be able to try and answer and address any questions. You received this information from us on April 30th for your consideration in the final findings on CTS. So that's all we have. Where did he go? That's all we have, is just to deliver that information.
For some, yeah.
Oh, we got public testimony. I'm jumping the gun.
And then we have a couple actions.
If you're talking about item four, there's no public testimony.
Oh, okay. Then we will move on then.
Okay, item five. 5A, pursuant to Fish and Game Code sections 2075 and 2075.5, consideration and possible action of the petition and the department's one-year status report / recommendation on the petition to list the Pacific fisher as a threatened or endangered species and adoption of commission findings. 5B, request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 670.5, title 14, addition of Pacific fisher to the list of animals declared to be endangered or threatened. Please note that this item will only be considered if the commission makes a finding that the listing of Pacific fisher as threatened or endangered is warranted. As we've stated, we do not have a quorum today. Does the department have comments?
We do have comments, but there's no, I mean, I think we can defer this discussion until a quorum is present, if appropriate.
Do you have any questions for the department?
Commissioner Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. President. John, I agree with your suggestion. However, given that we're going to have some additional time on this issue, I'd like to, I know you're aware of the feedback that we've received from the chairman of the Assembly Water Parks and Wildlife Committee. You've had conversations with him. It seems to me that the department would be well advised to use the additional time to satisfy some of these outstanding concerns that have been expressed about the draft status review. I realize that it's been through a peer review process, and I understand that, you know, final documents often differ quite markedly from draft documents. But on the other hand, since we now have a rather public airing of the concerns surrounding the way that previous peer review was handled, it seems to me that we might all save ourselves a lot of heartburn by the department going back, even though it's not required to do so, the department going back and making sure that the outstanding questions and concerns surrounding that final status review document are fully addressed, perhaps by an additional round of peer review by the original reviewers. My understanding is the objections haven't been so much that the wrong people were involved in the peer review, but that their comments and feedback wasn't adequately incorporated into the final document. So that would be my suggestion on how to use the time we now have available to us.
The concern about that is two-part. One, it would be an additional step in our regular process, and frankly, that's neither here nor there. We could discuss whether or not that's beneficial. The only other thing is that it looks like we got about 10 days or 12 days from now before the commission is going to be meeting again. Remember that we do have a what I characterize as a 2084 problem, that is lack of coverage right now for Pacific Fisher on incidental take. So we're concerned that the action be relatively quick. And so, I mean, certainly what I would suggest is that we describe to you in a written form for your next meeting the process that we've gone through in terms of how we typically go about what's called peer review, although it's not peer review in the academic sense, and I think that's an important distinction, and kind of describe what our process is. And I think that will help the commission understand a little better what we go through in these things, if that would satisfy.
Thank you, John. Is it your sense that that would satisfy the chairman of the assembly committee?
Ultimately, I think that the chairman has indicated to me that he wants the release of our in-process documents, and that's a privilege that is explicit in the code, and I'm not too sure I'm prepared to be able to release those documents.
Let me just to see if we can get to closure on this. My concern isn't so much the release of the draft status review, but to ensure that the final status review is as bulletproof, so to speak, as possible. It appears that there's sufficient concern about the adequacy or the way that the original peer review comments were incorporated or not, that the final status review has been called into question by scientists, now by politicians. Under those circumstances, to try to address that by simply explaining the department's procedure doesn't really go to the merits of the issue. That's my fear, is that we're simply setting ourselves up for additional litigation. Now, that may be inevitable in any case. No matter what our decision, one side or the other is going to file lawsuits, and that's fine. But it seems to me we might be better advised to go back to the drawing board here and redo this peer review process following department's guidelines. Now, I also understand the incidental take issue here. Frankly, I'm more concerned that we get this right than that we, and even if it requires a gap of a few months in the incidental take without an incidental take permit for the companies involved. But I know that there are what worries me here, of course, John, is that this has been elevated to the political spectrum, and the department's procedures have been called into question. And I just think the smart way to deal with this is to take a step back and say, fine, whether there's any merit to these or not, we're going to make sure to over-comply and just clear the air, do it again, make sure we do it right, and forestall any further escalation of this issue.
And I share your concern that it is going to continue to escalate. I don't think, however, no matter what direction we head, that we're going to really resolve it. The other thing that I think is important to point out is nobody's really questioned the science in the final report. And we stand by that report, by the way. We're absolutely clear about where we think the recommendation ought to be. But what has been called into question has, by and large, been the process used. And I question the process used. I'm not real pleased with it, and I'd like to fix it. I hear your concerns. I certainly will take that into consideration. We really do need to cogitate on this and, frankly, work through our process and see where we end up. But we're not there today. Had you had a full commission today, we probably would be there and we would be recommending action. But
well, I certainly don't mean to tell you all how to do your job, but you get enough of that from the commission as it is. But in this case, it just looking at this from a sort of reasonable and prudent perspective, it just strikes me that our collective best option might be to take a step back and consider all of this controversy and try to prevent it from going any further. Yes, thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of public speakers on this item, 3 minutes each. Pamela Flick, Gary Reinierson, Justin Augustine, Tom Engstrom.
Good morning, Mr. President, commissioners, staff of the commission and department. My name is Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife. We feel strongly that the concerns expressed in our letters to the commission, including our most recent letter of May 2nd, have not been meaningfully or adequately addressed. It's important that the commission base its decision on the best available and least contested information. The commission has heard from several of the peer reviewers of the draft status report via letters and public testimony regarding their concerns about the peer review and how it was handled. Another peer reviewer, Dr. Keith Aubrey from the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, just submitted a letter yesterday to the department outlining his concerns and offering suggestions to improve future technical reviews. Besides being given just 5 days to do a comprehensive review of the document, a timeline in which he himself described as unacceptably short, he argues that no attempt was made by the department to formally reconcile the technical review comments offered, which is normally done for scientific documents. Such reconciliation document contains the response to comments received and provides a direct link between the original document and the final draft. We concur that Dr. Aubrey, that the draft status review and reconciliation document should have been included in the public record, and his statement that, quote, it is completely inappropriate to include our technical review comments as part of the public record, but not the document that we reviewed. As Assemblyman and Chairman of the Water Parks and Wildlife Committee, Jared Huffman noted in his April 15th letter, the state of Washington releases their draft status reviews for public comment as part of their state listing process. And I wager a guess that the draft documents include a recommendation as to whether listing should occur or not, a key aspect that was missing from the Fisher draft status review. It is clear that new information was added to the document, which, as one peer reviewer noted, was not appropriate. What doesn't seem clear is why DFG does not want the final product to be re-reviewed by the original peer group. Any other published document would undergo such process, and it could make the final recommendation more transparent and less dubious. I'll end with the following passage from Assemblymember Huffman's May 4th letter to the commission. Quote, I urge the commission to postpone a decision until the final report is peer-reviewed. I believe under the circumstances to do other than this will only invite litigation and undermine the public's confidence in the science and credibility of the process. Thank you.
Before the next speaker, one thing I wanted to announce. We are going to move to items 16, 18, and 19 next after these public comments. So if you have a speaker card for 16, 18, or 19, please turn them in to staff. Thank you. Gary Reinierson, Justin Augustine, Tom Engstrom.
Mr. President, Commission members, and Mr. Director and staff, I would urge the Commission to move forward as quickly as possible to make a decision on this particular item. The 2084 is no longer providing coverage. We do not currently have incidental take coverage, so the sooner that we could resolve this issue, I think for all parties concerned, the better off we are. I also want to talk for a minute about not the peer review process, but comments made as part of the peer review process about non-peer reviewed data being included. The development of the data in our understanding of the fisher is probably one of the best examples of cooperative research, if you want to call it that, through private and both federal and state public organizations. The recognition that we have a very elusive animal that needed a lot of study to understand how this animal uses the forest, what forest habitats it uses, what is the nature of this animal in its use of those particular forest elements. The cooperation between public, both the Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as all of the private landowners who have this species on their land, is remarkable. Now, when we conduct studies on our properties, when we conduct surveys on our property, they are to inform us of what is going on the property, how what we're doing may affect certain species, and then to monitor that over time. It is not intended to write a scientific paper that will withstand absolute peer review that so it can be published in a scientific journal. It is to provide those data to for us to help us manage and provide the data as we are required to do through our habitat conservation plan and other agreements. We collect those data, we provide them to agencies, the agencies then use them to help them better understand what's going on. This is the same process that occurs in the development of environmental documents. EIRs, EISs certainly do not have a peer review process that would withstand that was identified by Dr. Barrett. So with that, I can tell you that our system relies very heavily on the technicians and the biologists that collect these data and provide them and then help the qualified biologists then work with forest managers to understand what the best application is and how to provide protection for these species over time. Thank you.
Gary, before you go, just a quick question. Two things, really. One, I want to get a sense of just how problematic not having an incidental take permit is for your company. What is it that you're not able to do that you would ordinarily want to do on your land because you don't have an incidental take permit? And secondly, the issue we've talked about before with respect to what additional steps you'd have to take to protect fisher habitat that you're not already doing, assuming the animal's listed. What would you have to do differently? And my understanding is you're already doing a lot, commendably, under your habitat conservation plans for other species. It's not clear to me that you'd have to do anything additional, any additional conservation steps for the fisher that you're not already taking for spotted owls or other species.
But I think that's the key. It's not clear to us either what additional measures we may or may not need to take. The take standard is to fully mitigate. So if we are to obtain a incidental take permit, we have to ensure that any take that may result must be fully mitigated. We don't know what that means under the current process. We don't know what that would mean in the issuance of an incidental take permit. We've trained our loggers, we've trained our fallers, we've trained the folks to look for nests, to understand where these species may occur. And if they see any indication, to stop operations, contact our wildlife biologist, and proceed from there. So we are trying to ensure that we do not cause a take, and we'll continue to operate in that manner as long as we do not have incidental take coverage. It's the same as driving down the road without your driver's license. You're fine until there's a problem. And we certainly do not, we're trying to prevent any problems. We're trying to certainly prevent any take from occurring, but it's putting us in a difficult position.
So you haven't had to suspend logging operations or anything like that as a result of not having a permit?
No, we have not.
Thanks, Gary.
Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President, if I may, just to add a little bit to that, and you'll find this described in the report, there's an enormous amount of voluntary activity that occurs on the landscape statewide in order to try and ensure preservation of fisher. So that voluntary activity likely becomes mandatory in this kind of circumstance. So that's kind of the thinking that's been going on here.
Justin Augustine, followed by Tom Engstrom.
I'm Justin Augustine with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I think the points in my most recent letter make clear there is still quite a bit of work to do. For instance, we still need an assessment of whether the fisher is threatened in a significant portion of its range. That's what the law requires. We don't have that. We still need proper peer review. I think all the letters that have been sent in make that abundantly clear. And we still need a cumulative assessment of the threats fishers face. We don't have that yet in the final status review. We also still need an accurate assessment of the literature and of habitat. Focus on the word accurate. We don't have that yet. Broadly speaking, what DFG management needs to do is allow its staff to create a document that we can make meaningful decisions from. During the petition process, DFG biologists outlined what could be done during the status review to effectively address fisher conservation. I think there were 8 specific things. I don't have that in front of me. 8 or 9. And what we currently have clearly does not reflect that outline. I would just say, you know, what we really need to do is be upfront about what we know about fisher habitat, what we know about fisher distribution, and what we know about the current state of forests in California, and then to cumulatively, assess that. So let's make a meaningful document and then make some honest decisions. And that's all we can really do. Thank you.
Tom Engstrom is our final speaker on this one.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Tom Engstrom, representing Sierra Pacific Industries. I just wanted to basically second a lot of the things that Gary Reinerson said. We've been collecting data on fisher to help the management of our properties for the past few years. These are elusive animals, and we haven't been really collecting the data in order to write scientific papers and have them peer-reviewed. We've collected them in order to better manage our lands, and as a result, we've changed our management practices to provide more habitat, we believe, for fishers to use, not only in the areas where they currently exist, which are in logged areas. In fact, we're finding a lot of fisher in logged areas where the scientific papers just say they're not supposed to be. So we're collecting this data, and we're also extending this to the areas where we think the fisher should be reintroduced to Sierra Nevada. And as a result, we have been working with the trustee agency, not necessarily in the scientific community, but the trustee agency, the Department of Fish and Game, and the Fish and Wildlife Service of the federal government to reintroduce fisher. We're taking very positive steps, and this listing will... I think it will hamper the reintroduction efforts in the Sierra Nevada. We don't see that the fisher are particularly threatened or endangered, and we just want to support the department's position. We collected this data in good faith. We submitted it when the data was asked for, and we feel that the department did a fair analysis, and we encourage the commission to move forward as soon as possible because this is... introducing a lot of uncertainty in our timber harvest planning process. As a result, we do support the department, and we encourage the commission to not list the species as endangered or threatened. Thank you.
Mr. President.
Commissioner Shedd.
I have a question for the department. Is it true, this allegation, that if you list a species, it actually hampers reintroduction efforts? That doesn't make any sense to me.
It increases the complexity of handling the animals, that's for sure. So it would make it more difficult to do that. I don't know if hamper is too strong a word. I frankly don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, we're going, before we go on to the next item, we're going to take a 5-minute break.
Okay, as I announced, we're going to move items 16, 18, and 19, and then we will go back to item 6. Item 16, update on the status of the draft environmental document regarding bear hunting and receipt of the public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 265, 365, and 366, Title 14. Use of dogs for pursuit slash take of mammals or for dog training bear and archery bear hunting. We have Sankey Master from the department to say a few words.
Yes, good morning, Commission. As those who were at the Altoucher subcommittee meeting yesterday, that group heard me discuss the fact the department is still looking at its options and how to proceed with the environmental document for bear hunting, and as soon as we have some options for you, we'll report back to you as soon as possible.
We have three public speaker cards, 3 minutes each, please. Virginia Handley, Bob Bentz, Bill Gaines. Since we went out of order here, if you still want to speak, get your card in right now.
Hello, Virginia Handley, PAWPAC. I guess I really don't have much to say because we're all waiting to see what the department would like to recommend. And I think our views have been expressed over this time element. And so we encourage you to put not to expand the bear hunting into the San Luis Obispo or to expand on the training dogs on the bears. And I do want to remind the commission once again, you are required under the Fish and Game Code 203.1 that along with considering the populations, habitat, and all that, you are to consider the welfare of the individual animal. And if there's some document that's been put out that shows that it used to be in the environmental document, it's no longer in there. And at one time it said, we are putting it in this environmental document so that you can go to one place instead of having to go elsewhere. Well, I don't know of any elsewhere to go. I don't know if there has been anything written up in response to that consideration. I would love to see it, but I don't think it's there. Thank you.
Bob Bentz, followed by Bill Gaines.
Hi, I guess I'll just speak extemporaneously on this one. I sure didn't come here to talk about bear, but I did mention them earlier. I've never seen so damn many bear in my life. I'm 63 years old, and the damn things are everywhere. Like I said earlier, it seems like they got more rights than I got out in the woods anymore. I've had bear come within a few feet of me. I can name campsites on 88 and Highway 4 and up on 50 up around Wright's Lake and Ice House and over at Post Pile. The bears are so populous now and so tame that I've witnessed several camp raids, and I've seen families go home early from the Sierra because the bear literally came in the tent and took an ice chest and helped themselves. I remember as a kid, we used to hunt bear in some of the old apple orchards, and well, a lot of those trees don't have branches on them anymore. up in Tuolumne County. I still gather an apple now and then, but the bottom line here is that I can't believe the overpopulation of bear, and I would very much like to endorse increasing the take to a level that's contemporary with what we used to do. Aside from that, the use of dogs makes a lot of sense to me. We have to go back to a time when the bear are afraid of people, not willing to come into their tent. Thanks much.
Bill Gaines.
President Kellogg, members of the commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and I'm here today representing over 30 wildlife organizations, including the California Houndsmen for Conservation, who are members of ours. The California Outdoor Heritage Alliance strongly supports the use of sound science when it comes to making wildlife management decisions. There's a lot of public emotions associated with the bear proposal that's on the table. We know a lot of questions came in on the CEQA document, which is one of the reasons why the department had the table making any changes to the previous regs on bears. We strongly support the Department of Fish and Game, given the time to answer those questions and complete that document so that it stands with the best available science. And we urge the commission to direct the department to do so and to bring that revised document back with all those questions answered at their earliest opportunity, with a new set of recommendations for the bear harvest in 2010 through 2012, and that the commission at that time reconsider those regulations for the current 2010 season as well as the following 2 years as well. Thank you very much.
That concludes public comment on item 16.
Okay, the only comment I would like to make is that because the environmental document having some issues, and the department needing to get that together, that we go ahead and just, so we can get this thing over with one way or the other, notice it for the June meeting in case that document is ready by then, so we can encourage you to move really quick.
Yeah, the document will not be ready by June, but that doesn't prevent the commission from going to notice with a rulemaking. It's just before you could adopt a rulemaking, we'd have to make sure to have a certified environmental document. We just don't know how long that's going to take us yet. That's the only caveat.
Well, and commissioners, we can go to notice. We don't need a vote today to go to notice. Staff can publish notice before June if you'd like, and this can be counted as our notice meeting. And then we would have we'd have to determine when we would have a public comment and a possible adoption. So,
well, because of the timing and where we might be able to have something to fit this in, we should do that. Okay. We don't have to, I mean, we can just direct staff to do that.
As far as an eyesore, though, what is you already really have an eyesore together. I mean, we just have to kind of cut and paste out of, or use what was used before.
Right. What I was going to ask is the simplest thing would be to take those parts that we took no action on and repackage them into a bare eyesore using the existing options. I just wasn't sure if the commission, based on any of the testimony, wanted to modify any of the options or look for additional options in that eyesore. What we could do is at June, agendize the item. We could present you a draft, see if there's any changes you want to make, and then go to notice after that. I still think that would give us time, Commissioner Kellogg, to do what you want to do.
Mr. President, that makes a certain amount of sense to me. And Sankey, I hope that, and I expect that, as usual, one of the options will be no action, no change, status quo.
Of course. That's always a standard option. And for example, one of the things I think that's worth discussing is at the previous two meetings, there was a lot of confusion about what the impacts or the consequences of getting rid of the quota would be. And I think you could ask us, or we could recommend an option that would take that concern off the table so that people would, for example, you'd raise the quota instead of getting rid of it. That's another option. So I think there's ways to improve some of the communication and clarity if we redraft it. So that's why I kind of wanted a chance. I think it'd be fruitful to have a discussion before we actually notice the thing.
I agree with that, Mr. President, and something I've talked to Bill Gaines about offline. If we think about what is in the long-term best interest of the hunting community here, this proposal, as you all know, has stirred up a tremendous amount of interest and controversy among the non-hunting community and among public officials in the areas where this proposal would affect. I'm not sure that pushing this through as hard as we can is in the long-term best interest of the hunting community, frankly, because it could trigger a backlash that would ultimately leave bear hunters worse off, not better off, than they are now. So thinking strategically about this rather than just tactically might be a good idea for everybody concerned. And it just certainly something that I think about, and I think shaping a thoughtful and a better eyesore with that in mind is I'm all in favor of that.
Okay.
That's what we'll target. When it comes right down to the rubber meeting the road, we can separate things out if necessary. So,
as staff, I would say that I suggest that we put this identical agenda item on the agenda at the June meeting, and we can get a status update on the environmental document and talk about authorizing notice of the eyesore. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
That concludes public testimony on item 16. Moving on to item 18, receipt of public recommendations, a request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 300, title 14, CCR related to upland game birds. Doug Updike from Wildlife Branch.
Oh, this is on. Okay. President Kellogg, Commissioner Sutton, I'm Doug Updike with the Wildlife Branch of the Department. The Department has prepared an initial statement of reasons for Section 300 that we've provided to you, which makes changes to upland game bird hunting. The only change that is proposed from the Department relates to providing a range of permits for hunting sage-grouse. There are two locations in California, in Lassen County and Mono County, where we currently conduct sage-grouse hunting. There's less than 100 permits that are issued annually. In early March, March 5, the Fish and Wildlife Service took action and made a determination that the sage-grouse is warranted for federal listing under the Endangered Species Act. And as a result of that and additional suggestions on their part about a distinct population in Mono County, that both of those actions by the feds have been recognized by us, and as a result of that, we are giving the commission then the option to make changes in the number of permits for sage-grouse hunting. We've conducted our recent LEC counts in both those areas. We're in the process of doing some final analysis. I believe the analysis will show that we could go either way, but to be cautious and to follow the lead from the feds, that we would recommend potentially going clear to no hunting of sage-grouse for a couple of years, continue to monitor that, look for any effects, if there are any. We don't believe that hunting right now is the major factor for these populations. It seems very clear that it's habitat-related, in particular to management of fire, invasive species like cheatgrass, etc., diminishing habitat quality for these birds. but at least this would give us an opportunity. If hunting were taken off the table, we would be able to see whether or not hunting is indeed a factor. It's, I think, important to recognize that Nevada, on the other side of the Mono Lake population, they ended their hunting of sage grouse in that local area in 1998 while we continued on. So still discussion to come, I think, but the eyesore has been presented to the commission for their consideration.
We have one public comment speaker, Bill Gaines, coming from the back of the room again.
Perhaps I should be sitting towards the front. Again, President Kellogg, members of the commission, and department staff, my name is Bill Gaines, president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. We're very, very pleased to be working closely with the Department of Fish and Game on the upland game regulations for the upcoming 2010 upland game season. One of the primary things that we'd like to insert in this year's regulatory package for the first time is the ability to use the 177 caliber pellet guns for the taking of turkeys. Currently, as you know, pellet guns that have a caliber of 20 caliber or higher are legal. 177s, which are much more easier to obtain and every bit as effective as the 20 caliber or greater pellet guns, currently are not allowed for the hunting of turkeys. And in discussions with department staff, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be. So that's one of the many things that we're pleased to work with the department on during the upland game scoping process, and we look forward to supporting the department's recommendations that will come forward to this commission sometime here in the very near future. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Sutton.
Let me just make sure I understand the point about sage grouse. What does the eyesore currently suggest that California is doing with respect to sage grouse? Are we planning a hunt or not? I apologize for a rather uninformed question, but just want to be clear.
I apologize for being in another conversation, and I'm sorry I didn't hear the question.
I'm just trying to thanks for your presentation earlier. I just wanted to get clarity on what exactly we are planning to recommend, what the department's recommending in terms of a sage grouse hunt for this year.
We are recommending, we've opened the options to make a selection from within a range from no hunting to the current level that is allowed in the regulation, and to select then within that range as we get additional information from the analysis of our LEC counts, which we expect to have actually next week. So after that analysis, I think we would have, the department would have a more focused recommendation within that range.
Thank you for that. It seems to me the general trend is beginning to argue against a hunt, given the actions of Nevada and the listing petitions at the federal level and so forth. It's not looking good for sage grouse.
I would just like to comment that one of our staff members, Scott Gardner, has been active on the interstate level on the AFWA and the WAFWA's sage grouse committee, looking at the issues threatening sage grouse across the continent, and specifically our populations in California in the best path. You may or may not be aware is California's spent a lot of energy managing sage grouse over the decades, and we've had closed seasons before due to heavy winters and concerns. The issue now is it's not so much things happening in California, but on the Great Basin habitat in general. And we're right now in the deliberations with Fish and Wildlife Service and some of our neighboring states on what would be the best course of action. And that's kind of Doug's referring, not only just LEC counts, but what the Fish and Wildlife Service believes we should be doing. So we're in dialogue with them right now, and frankly, it doesn't look good for some of these populations. We're not so much concerned, but it's the global context, and some of the genetics recently suggests that we have some rather unique populations in the state, and that kind of changes the management strategy. So you will be hearing from us shortly on that.
Thanks, Saki.
Item 19, receipt of public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to consider amendments to the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2010-2011, sections 502 and 507, Title 14, CCR. Senior biologist Dan Perigary.
Staff environmental scientist. Good morning, Commission. Dan Perigary, the Wildlife Branch. I'm only going to speak to Section 502. We typically provide a range of alternatives because we're still waiting for survey data, frameworks from the Fish and Wildlife Service, so there's really no specifics there. We do have three other items that we are considering, you know, final recommendation for change, two of which came from public scoping efforts. One regards a increase in season length for Great Basin Canada geese in the Central Valley, the Balance of State Zone. The other is a little more complicated because it involves our sister state, Oregon. They've got a proposal for a bag limit change that might affect our neighboring zone in Northeast, so that one's up in the air, but it's in the ISOR for your consideration. And then the fourth one is the change in the branch season dates. We got a specific recommendation from the public. We're not sure whether other members of the public are going to support it, so there may be a little bit of conversation that needs to occur relative to that specific. And then lastly, just as a reminder, the timing of events. We're still trying to do our May surveys for California ducks right now. We're having a heck of a time with the weather. It's either windy or raining. The flyway meetings will be in late July. The service will have their regulations committee meeting on July 28th and 29th. At that point, we'll have the frameworks and our ability to make a more specific and final recommendation on or about August 2nd, which will be right in front of your commission meeting. Unless there's any questions, that's all I had.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions? We do have public comment on it.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. I didn't realize we had another speaker.
Commissioners, Rob Allen with the Law Enforcement Division. The intent of the change in Section 507 is basically for clarification purposes. The current wording relates to mechanically operated or electronically operated devices that are prohibited between the start of duck season until November 30th. So what we've done in this is we've tried to clarify what this means. We've had questions about what is mechanically operated. So what we have done is clarify that, and the prohibition deals with electronically operated devices and anything other than natural wind-powered devices between the opening of duck season and November 30th. That's one thing we tried to clarify. The second was the spinning blade or spinning wing device. There are currently devices that have spinning blades that are underwater, and that wasn't the intent of the regulation. The spinning blade actually attracts the ducks, and so what we did was we tried to make it relate directly to a spinning wing or blade that simulates a wing device. And that was the clarification that we did in 507.
We have a couple of public speakers on item 19. Anthony Macaluso, Jim Waters, Bill Gaines. 3 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen of the Commission. My name is Anthony Macaluso. I consider it a privilege to be able to address this Commission today. I would like to see the regulation that is listed under Title 14, Section 507, Paragraph 4, Subsection C, which pertains to the use of spinning wing decoys revised. I'm a freelance hunter, and I've hunted in numerous places on the Delta. I've hunted waterfowl for the last 48 years. and have kept a very detailed log of not only my hunts, but the hunts of other people around the Delta. In 1985, I retired and started hunting every day of the waterfowl season. If there were 100 days, I hunted all of them. So for 25 years, I've gathered a vast amount of knowledge on waterfowl hunting, and I've kept a very detailed log of what affects waterfowl hunting. This logbook enabled me to predict on the Delta where I would get my best hunt on any particular day. When the spinning wing decoy regulation was put into effect, everything changed. Now my logbook was worthless. It didn't matter anymore what the atmospheric conditions were. All that mattered was who was using these spinning wing decoys illegally. Every year that goes by, more and more hunters are using them illegally, and when we are allowed to use them on December 1st, it is usually our worst hunt. My logbook shows this very clearly. What is very disturbing to me is hunters that I know that would never do anything illegal are telling me, well, Anth, if you can't beat them, join them. In 2006, at the beginning of the season, when spinning wing decoys were illegal to use, I flew out of the Napa airport and made a 50-mile loop around the Delta and observed approximately 100 illegal spinning decoys being used. In 2007, I made that same loop. The numbers nearly doubled. These flights were both on Wednesdays with no wind to spin wind-driven decoys. I have complained many times to the Department of Fish and Game about this problem, and I always get the same answer. We just don't have the manpower to enforce it. Last year, a pond that I've hunted by many times and that had been using these decoys illegally for many years, and then I have witnessed them take thousands of birds, got caught. They were issued a citation. Even though there was two hunters, only one received a citation. A couple months later, I heard they were bragging that the fine was only $200. These decoys are very effective when only a handful of people are using them in an area. It is not fair to the rest of us who are hunting legally. So basically, it's either use them or quit hunting, because you can't compete with these no matter how good a hunter you are. So my suggestion to the commission, along with that of many other hunters, is to make these decoys legal to use all season long, because you don't have the manpower to enforce this regulation. Number two, the spinning wing decoy was fairly new when you made this regulation. But now that they have seen them for at least 15 years that I know of, they're used to them. Even when we were allowed to use them all season long, after a week or so, you were better off just turning them off because they wouldn't work because so many people were using them. Number three, it is my opinion that you will actually save thousands of our waterfowl by changing this regulation. If this regulation is not revised, there are only two things that I could see that will happen. There will be more hunters using them illegally, or hunters will just quit because you cannot compete with these outlaws. I also feel it will be a big loss in revenue to this state. Now, if this regulation cannot be revised because it is politically motivated, then at least make the penalty for using them extremely harsh. Large fines, mandatory jail time, loss of hunting privileges for 5 years. So, ladies and gentlemen, something has to be changed because you can't enforce your current regulations. I'm not here today to point fingers at any particular persons or any particular area. I'm just here today to let this commission know what is actually happening out in the field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Waters, Bill Gaines.
My name is Jim Waters. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the California Waterfowl Association. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, thank you for being here today and letting me speak. On behalf of our board, the volunteers of our Regulations and Traditions Committee, our Public Policy Director, Greg Yaris, and his staff, Bill Gaines and the COA staff, we'd like to thank Dan Perigary and his shop for every year doing such a fantastic job and working with the stakeholders and putting together a package based on good science. I think it's been so successful, and we neglect to thank people the way we should, and so that's what I'm doing here today. And all we need now is a little cooperation from the ducks, and hopefully have a good season. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Gaines.
Good
President Kellogg, members of the commission, department and commission staff, my name is Bill Gaines, president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. California Waterfowl Association is the founder of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance and remains one of our major members. I'm also very pleased to have Rob Olson, president and CEO of Delta Waterfowl, on my board of directors. They're one of our main members as well. The waterfowl regulatory process is an exemplary process when it comes to the department working closely with the public to combine science with the desires of the public when finalizing their recommended regulatory package. For the past close to 20 years, I've had the pleasure of working hand-in-hand with Dan Perry-Gary, many of those years with the California Waterfowl Association's Regulations and Traditions Committee, a committee that Zonkey Mastriff, Dan Perry-Gary, and a variety of department staff have been very active in for the past several years. And the intent of that committee is to combine the department's biological folks and the latest biological data available in the waterfowl arena for that specific year, with various representatives of the public, representing public area hunters, private land hunters, North State, South State, Klamath, Imperial, pretty much every private representative out there is represented on this regulatory and traditions committee, so that we can get sound input from the public, combine that with science, and come up with a regulatory package that we can bring forward to the Fish and Game Commission. We're very, very pleased to be starting that process again this year. We know there's a couple of hiccups out there when it comes to Black Brant and so forth, but the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance and the California Waterfowl Association, as well as Delta Waterfowl, look forward to working closely with Perry-Gary and the department through that R&T process to bring forward a package that we can all support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Does that conclude the public speakers on this item?
Yes, it does.
Okay, I just want to, like I do every year, echo the comments about the job that Dan Perry-Gary has done with the waterfowl for the Department of Fish and Game. Dan, we really appreciate the hard work you did. I know you originally wanted to be a golfer, but ducks is really your call after seeing how you golf. So. But that, I mean, that being said, Dan has done a tremendous job. He was a huge part of us being able to increase the sprig bag limit in the state of California, and it's because of the hard work that he's done and the homework that he did to accomplish that we enjoy that extra benefit today. So thanks again, Dan. Commissioner Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll certainly associate myself with those comments. But beyond that, you know, waterfowl seems to me are a tremendous success story in wildlife management in a field that we don't have many success stories. It just proves that the old adage that if you save habitat and you don't kill too many, they tend to do pretty well. Wildlife tends to do pretty well. I just wish that, and that extends, the congratulations ought to extend to the California Waterfowl Association and other organizations that have been involved for this tremendous success. I just wish that the waterfowlers of California could share this success with the recreational fishermen of California who are opposing the MLPA, because it seems to me that what we're trying to do in the MLPA is exactly what we've done for waterfowl: save habitat and not kill too many. Wildlife tends to do pretty well when you do that, and I don't understand the opposition among recreational fishermen to saving habitat when waterfowlers have traditionally supported Ducks Unlimited, duck stamps, and the department and the feds' efforts to protect habitat. We know it's good for wildlife, just as good for fish as it is for ducks. So I hope that we can over time build a greater level of support among all sportsmen for protecting habitat and making sure we manage these species so that their populations can recover, as we've done so successfully for ducks.
Okay, we're going to go back to item number 6 at this point, and a presentation on the Safe Harbor Program by Chief Deputy Director Kevin Hunting.
Thank you, John. President Kellogg. Commissioner Sutton, thanks for the opportunity to speak before you today. I know you have a busy agenda. I'd like to make a few comments, and I've got a half dozen or so slides I'd like to show you just to kind of highlight a couple of private-public partnership programs that are underway at the Department of Fish and Game, one fairly new and then a couple that are well-established. One of the reasons that we felt it was important to get a little bit of time before you today or early this year is we're under John's guidance and leadership, we've recognized several key areas within the department we could do a better job of encouraging private lands conservation, take better advantage of some of the Farm Bill programs. There's some regulatory and statutory actions we could take to do a better job of capturing that important conservation principle. Another reason that we hope to get a little time before you today is the recent passage of the Safe Harbor Act. So I don't know who's controlling the slides. So just three major programs I wanted to just briefly cover, and then a couple of minor ones today are a recent passage of the State Harbor Program Act, a voluntary local program, and just a quick update on our NCCP program, and then I'll mention mitigation and conservation banking too, because that's kind of emerging as a more widely used and important conservation tool. I mean, the idea behind these programs, as you probably know, the voluntary local program and Safe Harbor is it frees local landowners, local private landowners, to do important habitat restoration for all species on private lands, without worrying about consequences of the Endangered Species Act and other regulations. So it's an important tool to take away disincentives that may be present for private landowners to do good things for all California species. So as I mentioned earlier this year, this bill passed that provided the department with a safe harbor program that more or less mirrors the federal program. So this is significant in many ways. We've got a lot of interest, a lot of inquiries on creating some of these programs locally, a couple of very significant ones. But, it's relevant in today's world because this could be one tool we could use to help recover California tiger salamander, for example, and provide Endangered Species Act coverage on a much broader scale for private landowners that are just doing what they do on their land, agricultural activities and other things. So we think Safe Harbor is relevant, especially today with some actions that are before the Commission today and currently. Voluntary local program is a program we've had in place for a while. It's got an accidental take clause, but it also, it's a program, again, that encourages voluntary participation with fish and game in conservation actions, and in return there's incidental take coverage for those actions. And that's many large private landowners, especially ranches and agricultural owners, have shown a lot of interest in this program and have begun to participate with the department in the voluntary local program and Safe Harbor. And we're hoping with some changes that we intend to make this year on how we participate more fully with Farm Bill programs that'll increase. Hit it again, please. So just a couple benefits. These are just some facts. As you well know, half the land base in California is privately owned. About 3/4 of the sensitive species are on private lands. So getting things off the list and stemming declines that lead to listing can't be done without participation by private landowners in California. It can't be shouldered solely on the back of public lands. Landowners, as I mentioned, it removes regulatory disincentives and provides assurances for private landowners to participate, establishing baseline conditions. So, in essence, they're conducting the same practices that they have been conducting on their land with very few changes, and in return get a pretty big regulatory incentive for that. What's shaping up to be kind of a big win under our voluntary local program, and I'm sure, commissioners, you're probably aware of this, is the California Rangeland Conservation Coalition Safe Harbor Program, voluntary local program that includes many parts of Tehama, Shasta, and Butte counties. It's got a broad backing, Cattlemen's Association, Farm Bureau, and others. And we completed a CEQA document on this program, the comprehensive program, late last year. We're still working through some of the issues on administration of the program. We're hoping that the California Cattlemen's Association will participate as part of that. But this is, I think this is a good example on a very large scale of how some of these private lands conservation programs can work. I'll just move on briefly to our Natural Communities Conservation Program, which I'm sure you're aware of. It's a large program we've had in place for over 20 years. Under the Natural Community Conservation Program, this provides long-term certainty for permitting, much like Safe Harbor and the Voluntary Local Program. But it also introduces the opportunity for significant federal and private dollars to be introduced for conservation. And the NCCP program has been very successful in garnering Section 6 and other federal funding to be passed through to local governments and our conservation partners to do to participate in these NCCPs. Here, just kind of summarizes what I just said. There's this in-kind services provided by the department and a variety of different fund sources that are brought to bear. It's kind of a snapshot of where we stand right now. There's 24 NCCPs in the process or operating in California, covering about 9 million acres throughout the state. So it is a significant conservation program, and changes in 2003 required some communication for connectivity between these active NCCPs. And some of the safe harbor proposals that we've been entertaining from our partners would be within these NCCP areas, but also would help connect them and expand kind of the conservation benefits across other counties. Commissioned fairly recently an independent evaluation of a Western Riverside conservation plan that's been up and running for some time now, and just a couple of the highlights: it saved several years in the permitting process for applicants, reduced the scope and possibly the number of litigation actions against applicants, the department, and the local government, and really just helped speed things up as far as realizing general plan build out and other kinds of actions taken by local government. And just a brief mention of a couple of other programs that we have in place at the department. One's the Conservation and Mitigation Banking Program I mentioned before. This is a free market enterprise that encourages private parties to establish and operate conservation banks in California on a for-profit basis. It's been very successful, and it is expanding. We expect it to continue to expand. And then you're well aware of conservation easements, and then our investment of Prop 84, especially on NCCPs and other voluntary local program actions. There's some significant federal funding going into that program. That's all I had for you today. Unless there's any questions, again, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Commissioner Sutton.
Kevin, thank you for that presentation. You know, I have to say it strikes me that this is time well spent and money well spent for the department, because one of the criticisms we've gotten for years from the landowners and others involved with the Endangered Species Act is that the regulatory burdens are onerous and so forth. NCCPs, HCPs, all of the Safe Harbor program tends to mitigate against those arguments, and I think anything we can do to build support for endangered species conservation on these private lands is tremendous, terrific work. So congratulations.
Thank you. We have no public speaker cards on item 6. Moving on to item 7, receipt of legislative reports. 7A, Department of Fish and Game report. We have Deputy Director of Legislation, Susan LeGrand.
Good morning, Commissioner. Susan LeGrand, Deputy Director for Legislation with the Department. Good to be with you here again this morning. Just briefly, what's going on in the legislature right now? Budget hearings are resuming, finishing up any open items that were left open before the May revise comes out. It's expected to hit the street late next week. Specifically for the department, our subcommittees are meeting today and tomorrow to handle open items. Beyond that, looking specifically at legislation, we're still reviewing approximately 100 bills, looking at amendments that have come out of policy committees that have met, and as well as appropriation committees that continue to meet. Deadlines that we're looking at right now, May 28th is going to be the deadline for bills to come off of the suspense file in the Appropriations Committee. So at that point, we'll see what the legislature is looking at pretty seriously and what's going to move forward. Following that, June 4th will be the deadline for bills, the floor deadline for bills to be headed out of their house of origin. So a bill that was introduced in a house, if it doesn't make it off the floor by that date, it's essentially dead for this legislative session. The administration-sponsored bills that the department is working on, Assembly Bill 1995 by Assemblymember Gaines, it deals with the ALDS system, has cleared its house of origin, the Assembly, and is now located in the Senate, and we'll move through the process on that side. As of this point, I don't believe it's received any no votes, and it's been moving along pretty effortlessly. In addition to that, we have Senate Bill 1349, which is by Senator Cogdill, and that bill deals with the establishment of experimental populations. We've been working with some of the folks from the environmental community on that bill. They've had some concerns, mainly dealing with the scope of the bill. So it's been, at this point, it's been narrowed significantly to focus specifically on the San Joaquin River. We are in the process of talking with those stakeholder groups to get the final amendments ironed out. And that bill is currently located on the Senate floor, and we're expecting in the next week or so we'll have the amendments worked out and will be amended on the Senate floor. Other bills of interest, Assembly Bill 234 by Assemblymember Huffman that deals with transfers of oil. We received from the governor's office recently an approved opposed position. That position is based on what the bill does. First of all, it requires booming for every oil transfer that happens. That approved position is based on OSPR's current authority. Right now, they have the statutory authority and they have regulations in place that deal with oil transfers and response, and that includes booming. It is a gut amend from last year, so it is currently sitting in the Senate Appropriations Committee. It was on suspense, so it hasn't moved yet. So we'll be talking with the author on that bill as it moves forward. Assemblymember Saldana, which is AB 408, dealing with lobster. The governor's office has issued us an approved opposed position on that bill as well. That position deals with the potential costs that are associated costs to the department that are associated with that bill. We have been in conversations with the author's office and staff, with the sponsors of the bill, so they talking through some of those issues to see where we might be able to come to some type of an agreement to lower some of the costs to the department. So those conversations are ongoing. Assembly Bill 1956 by Assemblymember Monning, dealing with the feeding of condors, has also moved out of its house of origin, and it is located on the Senate side waiting assignment. Assembly Bill 2125 by Assemblymember Ruskin, dealing with marine spatial planning, is currently sitting on the Assembly Appropriations Suspense file. Assembly Bill 2223 by Assemblymember Nava, who deals with wildlife management areas and the use of lead shot. We received an approved oppose on that bill as well. The reasoning behind that position is the commission already has the authority to do so already, so we feel that we should move through that process first before we do something like this legislatively. And that bill is in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. Assembly Bill 2376 by Assemblymember Huffman is the bill that deals with the Department of Fish and Game strategic planning. It's currently sitting on the Assembly Appropriations Suspense file. Assembly Bill 2427 by Assemblymember Bill Berryhill, dealing with hunting and taking of game, which I understand there's quite a bit of discussion surrounding this bill at the Towsher Committee yesterday. The department has received an approved opposed position on that bill. We've issued a letter. We've talked with the author's office. And I understand that the letter was a bit confusing, and I take responsibility for that. We will fix that. But basically, the premise behind that position is that we are always concerned when a bill seeks to limit the authority of the department or the commission. So we've had conversations with the author's office. The bill actually was heard in committee and failed passage prior to us receiving a position or issuing our letter of opposition on the bill. Talked with the author's office. They understood our concerns. They were going to move forward with some amendments that were to address those concerns. However, the last committee hearing date for the committee was changed, so that bill will be unable to receive another hearing on reconsideration, so it's essentially dead at this point. Assembly Bill 2503 by Assembly Speaker Perez, it's the Riggs to Reef bill, continues to be amended often, and it's awaiting hearing in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. Senate Bill 1093 by Senator Wiggins, dealing with the Dungeness Crab Task Force. It's basically a sunset extension on the task force. It's sitting in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And finally, Senate Bill 1179 by Assemblymember Hollingsworth, dealing with free hunting days. The department does have a few concerns with that bill, and we're actively talking with the author's office about what some of those concerns are. And with that, that's all I have today. I'm assuming you'll have questions.
Commissioner Sutton.
Thank you, Susan. And thanks again for getting such a complete report into our binder. It's really great to have this information on a timely basis. I just want to flag a couple bills that we're going to talk about at the Marine Resources okay. Committee meeting later this month that we probably will have a special interest in. Three in particular, you've already mentioned them. 2125, Ruskin's bill on marine spatial planning, it's a readiness bill, if you will. I'm not going to presage our discussion later this month as to whether we're going to recommend a commission support these bills or not, but just you might want to pay special attention to these just because I think we're going to be particularly interested in these bills. 2503, the Speaker's bill on rigs to reefs, obviously has major implications for what we do. And then the third one, AB 2376, the strategic vision for the department and the commission. That, of course, goes beyond the marine environment. But and then just two other bills that you also mentioned that the department is opposing. Saldana's bill, which is we talked about last year, yeah. Which is an effort by the lobster fishermen to impose a tax on themselves in order to pay for more progressive management. It would be great to figure out a way to support that. The lobster fishermen want this. Mm-hmm. They've come to us. They want to pay for things like a Marine Stewardship mm-hmm. Council assessment of their fishery. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that's the kind of progressive work by fishermen we ought to encourage. And if they want to find a way to do us to pay for that by a fee. We ought to find a way to support it, even if it's not the mechanism that's in this bill. We ought to find some way to support that.
We have had significant conversations with both the Good. Author's office and the sponsors of the bill, so we're talking right. through some of those issues, and yeah. you know, hopefully we'll be able to come to an agreement where they can get what they're looking for, and we can make sure that it's not a huge cost to the department.
Great. Yeah, so. Exactly. I understand the department's concern. And finally, just 2223, the NAVA's bill on non-toxic shot on wildlife management areas. If the department's going to oppose that, I know we're going to talk about this next month at the June meeting we have on our agenda, the management of state mm-hmm. lands, hunting on state lands, and we've asked the department to develop a recommendation for us that would include a ban on use of toxic shot on state wildlife mm-hmm. areas. So we'll have that discussion. I'm all in favor of the commission acting in advance of the legislature, so I don't have a problem opposing that as long as...
That's the reason for our opposition of the bill, is because you already have the authority to do that, and we feel strongly that this is where those types of issues should be handled.
I agree with that. I do hope the commission can take action on this without the legislature having to preempt us, as we've seen in the past.
Okay. Director McCammon wanted to make a comment on your previous bill you spoke on.
If I may, I wanted to clarify the on the lobster bill. Frankly, the participation in the industry is real important, but the expectations laid out in the bill just do not match the budget that it contemplates. And until we can kind of resolve that, I think we're stuck with that bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two public speaker cards on this, Paul Weekland and Virginia Handley.
No, thank you.
Virginia Handley.
Virginia Handley, PAWPAC. And I don't think I can add much to that report. It's really a good, thorough report. It's been interesting, and some of these bills that have said that no one can regulate wildlife except the Fish and Game Commission, and then you turn around, there's another bill, like the Berry Hill bill, saying the commission cannot ban hunting or trying to take authority away from the commission. And I certainly think the commission should have certainly jurisdiction on all aspects of wildlife. This ACA 11 was a constitutional amendment on the right to hunt, putting it in the Constitution, and that bill died in the first committee. So it's been a very active year. I'm glad that there's concern by the department about the Hollingsworth bill on the two free hunting days. We were in opposition to that, and there was even quite a bit even in the analysis of saying that how things could go so wrong. I mean, what is the age of this person? How many people are they going to have under their supervision? There were just a lot of problems with it. That has gone to suspense and will come up at the end of May. And if you can find, and I applaud any action that you take on the lead shot. I think it is appropriate that you do it, and but also the legislature does has the privilege and the right to do it. Also, it's appropriate that you do it, and I'm glad to see that there'll be some action on that. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Mr. President, one other question for the department on legislation. We see from time to time bills like SB 539 that would propose to direct the Ocean Protection Trust Fund or the Ocean Protection Council to spend money on one priority or another. Is the department inclined to support or oppose those bill? It just seems to me that the Ocean Protection Council already has a strategic plan. For the legislature to constantly try to direct those funds to one place or another doesn't make a lot of sense, even though each of the bills may be perfectly justified. Yeah, I know you deal with these problems all the time, but I hope we can be unified in our opposition to these efforts, because I think we run the risk of making the OPC strategic plan irrelevant if we're constantly directing where those funds should go.
Mr. President, certainly the department consistently opposes the interjection of the legislature into administrative processes. They set up the OPC to make decisions, so leave those decisions with the OPC. That's consistently our position, just like it is with the department's responsibilities or the commission's responsibilities. So, yes, we're aligned in that regard. Now, whether or not we have an official position on a particular bill is a different thing.
Seven B, possible consideration in action or consideration of commission positions on proposed legislation. As we have said before, that will come through the subcommittees, and Commissioner Sutton has talked about Marine Resources Committee. Towser Committee is considering some recommendations, but we don't have them before us today. It's my understanding. So that concludes item number seven. Number eight, receipt of Department of Fish and Game informational items. 8A, receipt of Department of Fish and Game Director's Report. Director John McCammon.
Mr. President, members, a couple of quick things. As Susan pointed out earlier, we're in budget committees today and tomorrow and have been over the last couple of weeks, but the real issue resides with the issuance of the governor's May revise, which we're looking forward to at the end of next week. So that, I think, will be most telling about where the budget heads at this point. We have been working with the State of Oregon and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission to work forward, and with our federal legislators, to work forward an emergency declaration on the salmon season because of the reduction of the commercial season to about 11% of the prior year's take, and the in-river recreational system to about 17% of what it has been in prior years. Those are significant enough reductions that the industries may not be sustainable without federal assistance, and we are moving forward with a proposed governor's declaration and moving that to Congress to try and get funds appropriated. The decision about moving that to Congress is ultimately up to Gary Locke, the Secretary of Commerce, the Federal Secretary of Commerce, but they do rely on governor's requests, so both Oregon and California are considering that at this point. Two permits were issued that I think are of importance to the Commission to, for your information. They are watershed-wide planning permits for both incidental take and under Section 1600 for the Scott and Shasta Rivers, which will preserve the fishery, the salmon fishery in both the Scott and Shasta Rivers. Those permits are unique in the history of the department in terms of being watershed-wide. The resource conservation districts in both those valleys have taken leadership to represent the landowners in the valley and have executed the agreements with the follow-on that they then work with the landowners to make the improvements required in order to avoid incidental take prosecutions and to come in compliance with Section 1600 of the code. So it's a novel approach, it's aggressive, we've been working on it for 5.5 years, and those permits are executed and underway. Landowners are encouraged to sign up by the end of May. And then finally, on our implementation of the EIS-EIR on planting, we heard this morning about the department not planting waters. That's not true. As of August, or the end of April, we have 260 waters that have been cleared for planting under the protocol required in the EIS-EIR, which we've discussed with you before. That we anticipate doubling that number by the middle of summer. So in the neighborhood of 500 waters will be planted this year on the essentially 1,000 waters that will be processed over the next year and a half. We have people in the field daily working hard to get these waters cleared for planting. So we are aggressively pursuing as much planting as we can possibly do in the current year and anticipate planting in excess of 3 million pounds of fish.
Thank you, John.
8B, Fish and Game Commission guidance on scientific collecting permits in marine protected areas. Sankey Mastrip.
Good morning, Commissioner Sankey Mastrip, Deputy Director, California Department of Fish and Game. What I'd like to do is do a quick overview of the issue. We've had some discussions in the MR Marine Resources Committee earlier. As more and more of these MPAs go into place, the department is finding itself increasingly in a position of wrestling with this issue. So you will be receiving from us a more detailed discussion of the issues and our current protocols. But I think I would just initially want to tee up the issues, scientific collecting in MPAs, and essentially when and how much. As background, the Department of Fish and Game currently issues scientific collecting permits to persons or entities taking anything for non-commercial recreational purposes, and take is the department's definition. There we go. Request to conduct research and monitoring within marine protected areas is increasing at a pretty rapid rate. Currently, there is no guidance provided in the Marine Life Protection Act and or the master plan for managing research and monitoring activities in MPAs relative to this issue of scientific collecting permits. The cumulative effects of monitoring research activities are unknown, and the issue at hand is the need for short-term guidelines to control and restrict certain activities, especially invasive or extractive activities, until long-term comprehensive guidance for managing research and monitoring are available. And just some of the questions we're going to be looking answers for, in other words, to develop this guidance, is what level of extractive research or monitoring is acceptable in MPAs? What types of research gear is acceptable? You know, some have impacts to habitat, some don't. What are the cumulative effects of multiple research or monitoring projects before you hit some threshold that it interferes with the original intent of the MPA specifically? Should the request for research and monitoring be prioritized, for example, to academic institutions or partners get preference over unaffiliated researchers? And then kind of this volume thing, how much do you allow an area? You could see situations where research projects could interfere with each other in an area. So these are some of the things we'll be addressing and working along with Craig Schumann and others. We've been starting to address these issues, and we'll be coming back to you. But one of the reasons I want to bring this to your attention is we do have an existing protocol for making these decisions, and we may find ourselves in a situation soon where we're saying no to some, and they'll inevitably come to you and express their frustration with that. So I want to just give you a heads up. We're working on this. And we're looking forward to giving some guidance on this, or getting some guidance from the commission. Any questions?
No, I think we have some speaker cards first, and then...
Actually, we still have a couple items to go through.
We're going to go through the... Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. No questions, Honky.
There will be some public comment on this one, though. There will be public comment on that one. 8C, update on law enforcement division.
Commissioners, Nancy Foley, Deputy Director and Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. I'll just give you a couple of quick updates. There are two press releases going out today. One will announce our Warden of the Year, who this year will be Warden Robert Pelsman. He's out of the Forest Hill area. And the second one is the Shikar Safari Officer, Wildlife Officer of the Year, who will be Nicole Kazicki, and out of the Alameda County area. Both are great people, and I'll have them in front of the commission at our earliest opportunity. The second item is the academy. I just wanted to give you an update as to where we are with that. We still have 36 cadets in the academy. This is the fifth month that they're in there, so we've only lost six people so far, and that's great. And we have backgrounds going on 8 to 12 lateral candidates, so we're in the running. You asked, Commissioner Sutton, you asked for a couple of informational items last time. One is the recruitment and retention survey from the National Association of Chiefs of Wildlife Conservation Officers, and we will provide that to you for your next briefing binder, as well as the printed version of the PowerPoint that we provided as well. And then I'd like to introduce the Assistant Chief for the Central Enforcement District, John Baker, and he'll give you an update on the local area.
Commissioners, John Baker, Assistant Chief, Central Enforcement District. I'd like to welcome the members of the Commission to our district. Just a few highlights about what's been going on in the district. Just recently, one of my captains received a national recognition from the National Drug Czar regarding our enforcement efforts and our reclamation efforts with respect to marijuana gardens in the Central Valley. It was a very high honor for us to receive that this last year in Operation SOS. We actually were able to reclaim 66 garden sites, removing several miles of black poly pipe, illegal fertilizers, pesticides. Our officers in the Central Enforcement District alone chopped down over 118,000 marijuana plants as part of their participation in the operation. Overall, we took out over 465,000 in the joint effort. Additionally, we're really excited about, we have four new cadets in the academy and can't wait to get them and put them to work. And then I'd also like to take this opportunity to recognize my San Joaquin and Calaveras County squads and Lieutenant Eric Vielhauer. They have just done some outstanding work here in these two counties the last couple of years. And the teamwork and the dedication of the job that they've shown in light of all of the adversity we've had to overcome with salary issues and furloughs and whatnot, I just can't thank them enough for the work and their responsiveness to the public. So thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Update on Wildlife and Fisheries Division. Deputy Director Sankey Mastrip.
I don't have anything to report this time. Thank you.
Commissioners, I added item 8D to the agenda, update on Wildlife and Fisheries Division. And I'd like to, if you're okay with keeping that on for future, and we get updates from the Law Enforcement Division, and I thought it would be good to get updates from the other parts of the department. And if we can keep that as a standing item. And I don't know if you have any suggestions on what you'd like to hear, but to me, you know, we've been kind of lacking in department reports on what's going on with the wildlife, fisheries, and environmental programs, just as kind of status updates like we hear from Nancy. If you're okay with keeping that on, I think it would be good.
But Nancy's updates are exciting.
I think that we can actually bring some excitement if we try. If we try, we can.
Oh, yeah, we have all
coming
kinds
from
of
a former game warden over here, you know.
Yeah, no, we plan on providing you kind of part of it as an educational tool, because the commission tends to only hear from the parts of the department that are dealing with regulatory issues, and there's a lot of non-regulatory work. And I will be coming to you with some examples of particularly some of the working with local communities on a bunch of wildlife projects, the Guzzler programs. We're doing a lot of things. And then the policy stuff that I know you are interested in, we have, my division has several policy groups that are working on issues like, along with enforcement on how to deal with urban wildlife, like bears up in trees, et cetera. So we'll be coming to you with kind of things and expose you to things that normally you don't hear about.
8E, update on Pacific Fishery Management Council activities.
The department provided you a report, an update, and unless you have any questions, it's a fairly complete report, and we'll always be prepared to respond to questions if you have any in the future.
Okay, we have,
there's another.
I wasn't told there would be one. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the other is a result of previous discussion on the tribal issues on the North Central Coast. I thought it'd be kind of important to bring the commission a little bit up to speed. As you've probably heard, the department has been taking some initiative to try and develop a better working and communication relationship with the tribes in California. We don't have a good history of that. And because of the MLPA process, it has become obvious that we need to repair that situation. So we've been investing a lot of energy. We recently had a meeting of an extensive number of the coastal tribes back in April 9th in Sacramento, where we hosted. We hope to be able to share some of the results as soon as we get all the parties to come to comfort with what we can share with you. As you're aware, much of this information is held in confidence and is sacred in some cases to the tribe. So one of the things we're going through is getting to an understanding of what those are and how to communicate and how to work with the tribes in an effective way. And I wanted to highlight that there's a reason I believe the tribes in the North Central Coast didn't engage, and part of it is not having an established way to effectively communicate. So upon reflection, I see where the state this was a problem preordained because of the process. And so if there's anything I can advise the commission on working with the tribes is listen and give them a chance to discuss their issues, because we're developing this communication link, and it's going to take some time to perfect, and it's not the easiest thing, like I said, and we are working on the North Coast MPA study region to improve on previous efforts, and we are making significant progress. There are some substantive issues that have their own problems, but in terms of effectively working with the tribes and getting them to understand how they can work with us and the commission has really been an eye-opener for me and for the department, and I think we're making progress, but I do ask that we be patient with this, because it's new for all of us, frankly. So I just wanted to give you that context.
Thank you, Sankey. In that spirit, I'd like to suggest, Mr. President, that we, and in view of the previous discussion, the attorney for the tribe on the North Central Coast, that we agendize that particular issue for further discussion at the next commission meeting. I want to, like the department, I think we would be well advised to be responsive to this issue. It's apparently become quite controversial on the North Coast, and because the MLPA is silent on the issue of native uses of the marine and coastal environment, it would be a good idea if we took this seriously and responded to these concerns as best we can, working with the department.
And the department would strongly support having a discussion to better understand what the issues are specifically as the commission requested, and to discuss options.
Yep.
Okay.
Adriana wants to say.
I just wanted to point out, and I don't know if commissioners are aware, but we requested and have received a special assignment from the AG's office. Sylvia Cates has been assigned to us short-term to help us sort out some of these tribal issues. She has an extensive background, both within California and outside, so we've been meeting with her, and I have been working very closely with, Scott Williams, so we will keep you posted.
Mr. President, I know you'd agree that it's always a good thing to have more lawyers on the case.
Yeah.
Okay, we have three public speaker cards on this. I'm sorry, four. Leah Proto-Papadakis, Greg Helms, Michael Sheehy, and Paul Weakland. 3 minutes, please.
Hi, President Kellogg and commissioners. Thank you for considering this issue today. My name is Leah Proto-Papadakis, and I work for the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission, or the SMBRC. And I was a stakeholder on the South Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. The SMBRC is an independent state agency charged with restoring the Santa Monica Bay and its watershed. My organization represents our 34-member governing board, which includes local elected officials, local, state, and federal agencies, environmental and business interests, our 14-member technical advisory committee, the Southern California chapter of the California Clean Boating Network, and hundreds of concerned citizens in the Los Angeles area. We are interested in how the state will treat scientific collection permits within MPAs, because MPAs create unique research opportunities to better understand marine ecosystems. Much of our work is informed by the results of research conducted by local marine scientists, and we intend to be involved with the study and monitoring of MPAs moving forward. Several members of our technical advisory committee, three of whom served on the MLPA initiative South Coast Science Advisory Team, expressed frustration with the existing process to obtain scientific collecting permits and emphasized that the Department of Fish and Game need to revise its policies and procedures for issuing and managing these permits. While this broader concern is beyond the scope of the agenda item, the question that lies before you all today is one aspect of it, and it's imperative that you get it right. So studies involving collection and manipulation of the environment within MPAs, including no-take MPAs, should be permitted if it improves our understanding of the marine ecosystems. A higher standard relating to why the study needs to occur within an MPA should be applied when approving permits within no-take MPAs. Excuse me. The researchers that we work with hope that the Commission will allow such important research to occur within MPAs. They strongly urge the Commission to consult with active field researchers to advise you on these developing guidelines. And the scientists understand the need to protect species within MPAs and desire to work with the Commission and Department on how to do this while still learning all we can about this important resource through the unique opportunities of studying within an MPA. So thank you for your consideration.
Greg Helms, Michael Sheehy, Paul Weekland.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Greg Helms. I work in the Santa Barbara Field Office of Ocean Conservancy, and so it's no surprise that I've followed the Channel Islands MPA monitoring process pretty closely. Wanted to bring just a couple of points of context to your, I think, very justified work to really look at the scientific collecting permit process and make sure it's working and make sure it's as tight and set up as well as it can be. First of all, I think it's important to stir in very early that the backbone of MPA monitoring, the backbone of understanding the function of marine protected areas in improving conditions in the ocean is visual. It's non-lethal. That tells us whether we're improving conditions in those MPAs. It's the first tier, but that first tier is predominantly non-lethal. Now as we move out beyond that initial phase of monitoring MPAs, we may want to do certain types of monitoring that get at the less conspicuous species. We may want to involve traps, hooks, lines, and once you begin doing that, you got a decision to make about the disposition of those animals. Some of them can be, some of them can't be returned, but our backbone of MPA monitoring is visual, it's non-lethal, and so there's no giant conflict inherently in what we need to be doing. Furthermore, MPAs have this important role in helping establish reference areas, helping us understand and inform the process of fishery management. And getting into that, there's a number of things you can do. They're also non-lethal, but it's increasingly appropriate when you get into that area to be doing things like CPUE studies, trapping studies, those types of efforts. And there's going to be inside and outside MPA efforts in that regard. And you know, those are important if we're going to confer the benefits of MPAs to the fishery management process, understanding fished areas and their abundance relative to carrying capacity and the which we're hoping MPAs will do. So we have to address those. I certainly think that it's appropriate that the Fish and Game Commission work with its existing and its expanded resources that have come on board to make the process tighter. That's something we encourage, but those context pieces are important, and you should be looking at this as an opportunity rather than a conflict. Thank you very much.
Michael Sheehy, Paul Weekland.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on Agenda A, B, Scientific Permanent MPAs. I'm a marine biologist with Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. Before that, I was a research associate at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in the Marine Science Institute. And I've gone through the permitting process for scientific collecting for a number of years. And I would just like to echo some of the points that were made by the other two speakers. Primarily, the process that are already in place, rigorous process for permitting in our state waters, and I really appreciate the questions that are being considered and proposed to look at permitting and collecting within MPAs. I would follow that by advocating for more efficiency in the permitting process, especially given that we are looking at adaptive management techniques, which would really encourage efficiency in permitting over the years, as well as getting creative with collaborative research ideas moving forward with fishermen. Making those permitting efforts more efficient would really help on those two fronts. The thing I would also encourage the department to do is to really solicit for information from scientists that have gone through the permitting process in understanding really how best to approach that efficiency and moving forward with more rigorous permitting in MPAs. Thanks very much.
Paul Weakland and Caitlin Gaffney.
Your staff has averted you. Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I'd like to talk about the scientific harvesting. This is a conflict of interest for Mike Sutton. He can't participate in this. He shouldn't be able to participate in any of the no fishing zone MPA process. This shows how slimy and deceitful the whole thing is. Remember, this is how the Japanese are harvesting whales. Science. Yeah, I've handed out to you here that in Title 14, the law is in place for urchin harvesting in these marine protected areas. As an economic incentive, get to sell the catch. That's what all these scientists want to do. If they're not a grant-sucking parasite, they want to go into these no-fishing zones and harvest and sell this for profit. This should not be allowed. This demonstrates that it is a flawed concept, the wrong assumptions. Anyone that believes that managing the land resources is just like managing the ocean knows nothing about the aquatic environment. It is different. It always will be, no matter how much flawed science you pile on the pile. The other thing is, there's a push by certain individuals. They want to be special. We're smarter than you, so we should be allowed to go in these no-fishing zones. Remember, these zones have been set up because they are the most lush habitat. They have the most fish. They always will. The problem is now without fishing, you're going to have big fish because they're eating up all the little fish. So the little fish are disappearing inside these zones. This goes again to show the hypocrisy and contradictions of the flawed concept, the wrong assumptions of no fishing zones. The only activity that you're limiting. I feel sorry for the people in Louisiana, but it's a blessing for California because now new offshore oil drilling will not happen. One of your schemes and scams is falling by the wayside. Oh, yes. Want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about some stock at a Mariculture Ponzi Consortium? They need more investors. It's not nice to fool with Mother Nature.
Caitlin Gaffney.
Caitlin Gaffney with Ocean Conservancy. I wanted to speak briefly to the issue of enforcement. As the Commission and staff know, the North Central Coast Marine Protected Areas went into effect on Saturday, raising the importance of getting the word out about those new marine protected areas. We continue to believe that compliance is the better part of enforcement. Let the wardens focus on the true enforcement challenges, but let's try to increase compliance by making sure that folks know what the rules are and have the ability to comply with them. So to that end, Ocean Conservancy has been working with a lot of partners, I think, that are out to help the Commission and the Department on that educational task. One of our staff was joined actually by a commercial fisherman last week, and the two of them made a tour of the North Central Coast, visiting marinas and bait shops, basically anyone who would let them in the door, and they were passing out information, basic information about the new regulations. That includes directing folks to the Department of Fish and Game's website for all the detailed information. We also ran some ads in 5 newspapers along the North Central Coast, again, doing the same, just letting folks know that the rules have changed and directing them to the department's website for the details. So we're hoping that that will be helpful. And then I just wanted to provide one anecdote. We heard from someone, one of the staff with the Bureau of Land Management, who's a partner up in the North Central Coast at the Sea Lion Cove SMCA. And he let us know that they did something kind of creative. They actually had an electronic sign, those things you say, directing traffic on the highway. They put the sign up and let folks know the rules have changed. There's no take of abalone at Sea Lion Cove anymore. They said they found it to be extraordinarily effective.
They had a few folks come in. When they saw the warden, ranger, they turned around and headed the other way. So that may be a tool that they can use at least at really high-volume weekends in the future. Probably not every day, but I think a good use of sort of creative outreach to help get the word out. Just wanted to pass that on. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a lunch break now, and we're going to make it for 30 minutes only, and we'll be back at 20 minutes to 1. Start off, I guess, with item 9, John?
Yes, sir. Item 9, receipt of commission informational items. 9A, status update on expiring regulatory notice Z2009-0608-01, sections 235.3, 236, 238, and 240, Title 14, marking and inspections of live fish transportation vehicles and inspections of aquaculture facilities. Commissioners, we wanted to give you a heads up that this item is about to expire for the one-year APA timeline, and we're recommending just letting it lapse. The department may bring back a new proposal, and I'm not sure if the department has a plan at this point to bring back a new proposal. We're getting the head shake of no. So this one is, we're going to put out a notice that this is going to basically expire.
Terminate.
Yep. And I don't have a 9B, any others right now. We've got one speaker card for this item. This is Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. In California, we've had a long association with aquaculture since 1877. But what has consistently happened? Every time there's a failure, you wipe it clean. You purge the records. You cleanse the files. All the failures have been done away with. We start fresh again. How many fresh starts has aquaculture had in this state? About 5. After they have fouled the environment, they've poisoned the resources, their past practices and management show how deceitful and conniving they are, yet you continually give them the benefit of the doubt, the benefit of your power and authority. Want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? What about some stock in a mariculture Ponzi consortium? I believe some antitrust laws need to be explored here. They need more investors because that's what they do. They continually infest our environment. Just look at the abalone situation where aquaculture is responsible for the outplanting of abalones all over the state. Oh, but wait a minute. You have stricken from the records. You have purged it. No longer can we find withering foot syndrome or withering syndrome. Even the scientific name has been changed so to camouflage the event. This African cibellid polychaete worm, that terrible parasite? Oh, yes. We don't even list it as a thing to go look for anymore. We have just decided. What did Zonkey Mastriff say? Oh, yes. The genie's out of the bottle. Pandora opened the box. Oh, yeah, think outside the box. Yeah, so that is what you people are credited for. Denying all the failures. All the times that these people have gotten a business license, they've gotten your permission with a permit, they've gone out and had IPOs, these initial stock options, and they have gone bankrupt every time. I think something that should be investigated is how many of these aquaculture facilities have gone bankrupt. Quite a few, because that's the plan. You borrow as much money as possible, you get your grants from the education and stuff, and then you run with the money. This is all it is, a big scam. And not to have these vehicles, vessels, and these other things identified as aquaculture, because we know how detrimental they are. Not you. Oh, no. We're going to harbor and help this conniving, deceitful clan of fish farmers. And the stocking that you're doing, you know it's detrimental. But gosh, they got such a cool deal. It's such a sham that they got going. You don't want to ever stop it. So you're a party to it. And don't worry, you'll be well taken care of. That is all.
That concludes public comment on that item. Item 10, subcommittee reports and recommendations. 10A, Marine Resources Committee. We have Craig Schumann to give us a report.
Good afternoon, President Kellogg, Commissioner Sutton. I'm Craig Schumann, a Marine Advisor. Excuse me. The Marine Resources Committee update, we have published the notice of intent to amend the rock crab regulations that came out of the MRC. We are receiving comments and following up with commenters on that. We have submitted two proposed panels for the upcoming California and World Oceans Conference that will be held September 7th and 10th, 7th through 10th in San Francisco. I'm assuming those are approved. Those would be Marine Management in California to highlight the Marine Life Management Act Lessons Learned study that's been ongoing. That was proposed to be moderated by Commissioner Sutton, and then a panel on collaborative fisheries research that is proposed to be moderated by myself. We have an upcoming MRC meeting on May 25th in Monterey. The primary focus of that meeting will be to present the final report of the MLMA Lessons Learned study. We'll also have a presentation by Dr. Sherry Riccia of the NPA Monitoring Enterprise on the North Central Coast NPA Baseline Monitoring Program. We'll have presentations on data poor fisheries management. And this will include a discussion on the integration of MPAs in fisheries management. That's been on our priority list for quite some time, so I'm happy we'll be able to start focusing on that a little bit. We'll also be reviewing proposed ocean-related legislation that Commissioner Sutton talked about earlier. We're also working in a collaboration with Deputy Director Mastrup, Marine Region, and Dr. Riccia on a scientific collecting in MPAs, and we will hope to have something for you soon on that.
Mr. Sutton.
Mr. President, I'd just like to note that all the hard work that Dr. Schumann has done with the department on the rock crab regulatory package, that's something that we initiated as a result of stakeholder comments during the Marine Resources Committee meetings, and it's an example of the kind of action that we hope to see more of. But it wouldn't have happened without Craig Schumann's work, so well done, Craig.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Item 10B, Altauscher Preserving Hunting and Sport Fishing Opportunity Advisory Committee.
We had that meeting yesterday, and yourself and me and John Fisher attended with Sonke and whoever else is in the room, probably. There was a lot of people there. But John Fisher is going to give us a summary of yesterday's Altauscher meeting.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Tauscher meeting occurred yesterday at Yolo Wildlife Area. There were about 35 people in attendance. We talked about the Game Bird Heritage Program and had a good presentation from Karen Fothergill on that program. We also went in and had a discussion of upcoming budget, actually ongoing budget problems is probably a better way to phrase it, and potential vehicles for solving and funding, providing funding in this atmosphere. And Saki Mastrup volunteered to convene a small group to look at possible possible solutions to this problem. So that's one of the things that's going to go forward. Another thing that the Tauscher group did was they passed a motion to request that the commission support Senate Bill 1058, which deals with the fundraising tag measures. And so we'll be bringing that up to you at the next commission meeting. Then we also talked about the Youth and the Outdoors Subcommittee meeting. As you folks mentioned earlier, Sankey participated in this meeting. Dr. Eric Loft and Doug Updike from the department were there. And John Carlson, of course, was there, and I was there. And Mr. President, of course, you know you were there, too. And we've agreed to meet next tentatively on July 27th at Yolo Wildlife Area. So that's the basic summary, unless you have anything to add to that.
No, that's it. We got any speaker cards on this?
Well, I also wanted to mention on 10C Aquaculture Committee that has not met. The staff is working with the two chairs of that committee, and we hope to have a full-blown Aquaculture Committee meeting in the near future. We have one public speaker card on this. Paul Weakland. Paul, you've got 2 minutes left out of your 10 for today.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. At the last MRC committee meeting, the department brought up a priority one, scientific harvesting permits, and how that a lot of these aquaculture facilities have broodstock collecting permits. But it was a conflict of interest for Michael Sutton to be participating in such a thing, so now that's going to be swept under the carpet. These aquaculture committee meetings, now they have a tactical timeline. Oh, it's a tactical timeline they have, because they're going to present soon their all schemes and scams for aquaculture here in California. Yet the science and all the studies that have been done that show the failures have been wiped clean from the files. Ocean ranching, that milestone, that benchmark. Where did it go? Oh, you eliminated it from the record, so we can't look at the eyesores, the things that make you look bad, the cover-up. It's a terrible thing. Oh, want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about some stock in a mariculture Ponzi consortium? They need more investors. It's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. Save a little.
Number 11, receipt of federal agency informational items. Tony Morton.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Tony Morton with NOAA Fisheries. I wanted to bring to your attention a proposed rulemaking that we've got underway. I think that most people realize that the United States has some pretty stringent regulations in place to protect non-targeted fish species and other species of concern from illegal domestic fishing practices. But there is as much, if not more, concern about what's going on with foreign fishing fleets. NOAA Fisheries is in the process of considering options under authority of the Marine Mammal Protection Act for how the United States might identify foreign fishers who export products to the United States that are harvested without any particular regard for what else they are catching, harming, or killing in the process, specifically whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals. There are already processes in place to restrict imports of yellowfin tuna to the U.S. from foreign fisheries that take dolphins in the process of harvesting tuna, and the Magnuson-Stevens Act requires that illegal, unreported, and unregulated foreign fisheries be identified and reported to Congress. This particular proposed rulemaking is intended to level the playing field for U.S. fishermen and provide the basis for exchanging technology and information with other countries who may be willing to enact proactive measures but who don't currently have the knowledge or the ability. Comments from the public about this proposal are being accepted through June 29th at www.regulations.gov. And I think, as everyone knows, the Gulf of Mexico oil spill is a major news event right now and a resource disaster that could go on for a long time. NOAA is heavily involved in the interagency response team under the direction of the Coast Guard, and several NOAA line offices, including fisheries, the Ocean Service, the Weather Service, and our satellite group, are working to provide information to help track and predict where the oil is headed and how fast it's moving. We're conducting pre- and post-contamination samples and damage assessments at the aquatic resources in the Gulf, and we're implementing a fishing closure strategy to complement that of the states, and we'll have people assisting with any required cleanup. I know that there are also organizations and individuals from California's private and public sectors who are also on site or are waiting to be asked to come help in any number of ways. People who may be interested in learning more about what's going on down in the Gulf can go to NOAA.gov, and they will find a link to NOAA's Office of Response and Restoration, which is coordinating our efforts to assist with everything that's going on down there. The Department of Interior released a news release on Monday announcing the formation of an interagency task force that includes NOAA Fisheries, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Geological Survey, and the Bureau of Reclamation, and scientists from the state of California to set about working together to respond to the recent National Academy of Science recommendations about how to better incorporate new science into the two Central Valley biological opinions. That's the short-term goal of the task force. The long-term goal is to produce one integrated biological opinion for the Central Valley water operations that will also include the actions associated with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan that is under development. And my final item is more of a personal note. I need to inform you all that after nearly 33 years of federal service with six federal agencies, I have decided to retire. That's going to be effective June 4th, so I've got one more month. I just wanted to let you all know that I've thoroughly enjoyed being able to travel around the state with you and hopefully have provided a little bit of information on, kept you up to date on what's going on within NOAA and NOAA Fisheries in particular. I've enjoyed working with the staff and with the department personnel. There will be somebody that will follow up in this position eventually, probably 4 or 5 months to select my replacement, but we'll have somebody come here on an interim basis to keep our dialogue going, and then eventually whoever they select to replace me will probably be coming on a regular basis. And that's my report for today. Thanks. Yep, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you. How many years in?
Approaching 33.
Whew.
Yeah. The last 8 with NOAA. And,
great. So, well, thanks again.
It's kind of surprising that I've been doing coming here and visiting with you for 3 years.
So. I know. Time flies when you're having
sure
fun.
Does.
Huh?
All right. Thanks.
So will there be an interim person before you're that might be attending these meetings?
Yeah, starting next month. I'm not exactly sure yet who that is.
Should we check with Rod? Is that who we should check? Who should we check with?
Rod? I should know before I leave, and
okay.
I'll let you know.
Okay. Great.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, item 12, receipt of legal counsel informational items. I don't know if we have any today. We do not have any legal counsel informational items. I do have, Paul has this down. Weakland? Paul Weakland? New business? Any new business, commissioners? Paul, do you want, Paul has 1 minute left, commissioners. Did you have new business down, Paul? Okay. Number 14, we do not have an announcement of the results from exec session since there was no exec session with no quorum today. Item 15 is we have no public speaker cards today on this, and since we can't do a possible adoption without a quorum, we're going to table that and put that on the teleconference call agenda within the next couple of weeks. Item 17, receipt of department evaluation of the petition to list the mountain yellow-legged frog as an endangered species, or receipt and possible action of department request pursuant to Section 2073.5 of Fish and Game Code for an extension time of 30 days to complete its evaluation of the petition to list the mountain yellow-legged frog as an endangered species.
Commissioners, yeah, the department would request that this item be on your follow-up teleconference. We had planned to ask you for a 30-day extension, but depending on how long before you have your conference, we may not need it. But we would request that you put that on that same teleconference agenda. Thank you.
Okay, item number 20, receipt of public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 29.80, title 14, related to gear restrictions for saltwater crustaceans, lobster hoop nets. Assistant Chief Rob Allen has a few words on this.
Yes, Commissioners, Rob Allen with the Enforcement Division. The intent of this change in the regulations dealing with hoop nets is, for years there has been, in the regulations, it talks about how many hoop nets you can use, where you can use them, and those sorts of things. However, there's never been a definition of what a hoop net actually is. And through the years, the hoop nets have changed in their design from a device that lays flat on the ground to a device that becomes like a pyramid shape where the lobster actually falls into the device, and it's a little more efficient where it doesn't get out quite as easy. So what we did was we tried to come up with a definition of two different types of hoop nets based on what is commonly used out there right now in the field. This device has been progressing steadily throughout the last few years for more efficiency, so we're trying to define what it looks like prior to it becoming an actual trap. So that's what we did with this regulation for the most part, is try to capture what's out there now, working with the constituents out there, and by looking at the devices actually manufactured. So that's what you have in front of you now. But what I would like to point out is two separate things. With the version of this where it starts off in the regulations where it talks about gear restrictions, and there appears to be a spot that was overlooked in parentheses right there. It says this regulation becomes operative March 1st of 2011. The intent of this was try to make it become effective April 1st, 2011. That way we have one whole lobster season to go through and educate folks. Lobster season ends about the second week in March. So that way we have a whole season to get through before the regulation takes effect. So we can educate the public on that. The other was there was a public comment that came in, an email from a Jim Salazar, and he made a comment on the measurement of the Type A hoop net, that he would like to see an overall length when the hoop net is hanging from its rope attachment, and make that bag or the overall distance no more than 36 inches in height. We didn't add that to the requirement, but we don't have any objection to that addition to the language. So depending on what direction you want us to go, we could either add that language or leave it the way it is.
No, just I don't see any reason why we can't just proceed to public notice.
Right, but I mean, you're looking for guidance on whether to add that one in.
Yes, it's something that if it would have been brought up to me at the beginning, I would have added it to the language. It really doesn't affect much now. That's basically what the design is now, with a distance, how far the bag, the length of the bag when it's pulled, and it's not going to change much.
Well, since we haven't published notice yet, if the commissioners are okay with it, you could add it in still right now.
Yeah, we can always do
you could add discussion. It in before we go to, as an option, right, as an alternative. Yeah. That's the plan.
Okay, yes.
Add it as an alternative if Sankey has no problem with that. Commissioners okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And change to April 1st, too, for effective
yes,
date.
Yes, make that change to April 1st, absolutely. Okay, thank you.
That moves us to consent calendar. Items 21, 22, 23, and 24. I have a speaker card from Paul. He has 1 minute left. Paul, did you want to comment on consent?
We can't take any action.
Right, I'm going to move it to the teleconference.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, this is clear and convincing evidence that you are harboring this industry that the people of the state of California don't care for. But it's a scheme, it's a scam, it's a way to get investors. We already know the problems that are going on. This demonstrates the lack of any type of continuity in what's really happening, except for a scam by the greedy. And then you're going to allow a sublease of the people's property for a scam, a scheme, a research science project that is redundant, repetitive, that has been done many times before. And failure, of course, so the records have been cleansed. You've purged the files so that fresh start, another fresh start, see if rotting kelp can be a source of fuel. How many times have we done that in California? Well, we don't know because you've stricken it from the record. All the failures, the eyesores that make you look bad, disappear. And here we go again. Fresh start. Oh, want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about some stock in Americulture Ponzi Consortium? They need more investors. It's not nice to fool with Mother Nature.
So, commissioners, I will. Staff will move all of the consent calendar items to the teleconference call agenda. What I'd like to get a sense from the two commissioners that are present today, and we will follow up. Staff, we need to please make a note, Carol, tomorrow or today, if you have a chance, call the other three commissioners. I'm proposing Thursday, May 20th as a teleconference date. If we get the agenda out tomorrow, that'll give us plenty of time for our 10-day notice. Are you two available that morning? Would you be, Jim, available to come in to our office Thursday morning? Okay. All righty. Sankey, do you see any problems with that date, Thursday the 20th? Usually we try to do them at 9:30 in the morning, if possible. Yep.
Hey, wait a minute. I got a better idea.
Uh-oh. Jim's got...
Oh.
What's that?
I can't do it the 20th.
But that's... I don't know if that would be a big conflict for them. Is there much on this? This is a teleconference, Jen. I don't think there'd be anything. Oh, Sankey, do you see any conflict with RSG? Thursday the 20th?
Yeah, but I have this written in the wrong day. That's over there, so I could do that.
So you could come in, Jim? Okay. All righty. If that's okay with everyone, staff will work on that and try to get that agenda out tomorrow. And basically, we'll take the items that were not voted on for adoption today and everything that was to go to notice today, we are going to go to notice, so we will not put those on this agenda. It's just things that were up for adoption, and I don't think there's anything else that we're going to put on there. Yeah,
Mr. Carlson, one item. We got a letter regarding Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl duck stamp project acquisition, and maybe we could put that on the agenda.
Oh, right. Right.
So I think that could go on very easily if you think that would work out.
Yeah, I would recommend that too. Okay. That moves us to item 25, commission follow-up, meeting review, staff direction. This was a quick meeting. Maybe we can have more like this. No, just kidding. Staff will follow up on the teleconference agenda and announcement of future meetings. So we're going to attempt to have a teleconference on May 20th. Then June 23, 24 will be in the Sacramento area. Have we nailed that down? Is the Natomas Inn in Folsom? Yep.
Folsom?
Yep.
Is that Sacramento?
Yeah, it's just, west. Or east. East. Yep, June 23, 24. Then August 4 and 5 will be in Santa Barbara. And the rest of the year is on our website. We're working on that for the fall. Anything else, commissioners? If not, I think you are free to adjourn.
It's my job.
I said you're free to do it.
Huh. Right. Commission meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.